Welcome to episode 93 of JBW Podcast, Take 2. My name is Josh, and with me as always is Chris.
Hello. Take 2.
Hello. Today's episode, we're going to talk about tough guys and what's sort of become of them over the last few decades. So I think it's a really interesting topic, but this is kind of a wing it type topic because we realized after we recorded the last episode that Chris is actually going to be away for an extended period of time. So if we didn't record quickly, there was not going to be an episode to you guys for probably 5 weeks or something.
5 week gap. So we figured instead of that, we would throw our research by the wayside, come back a week later. We usually record like once every 2 weeks and record something so that we can at least get something out there so there's only a 3 week gap instead of a five.
Yes. So I think this will be pretty fun, but just
be prepared for it to be scatterbrained because
all we did for notes
was write down names and a couple movies.
Yeah. So. But we'll see where it goes.
All right.
Okay. So before we get started, actually a couple of shout outs. One shout out and one other thing, but the shout out, we just wanted to say thanks to listener Adam, who has been corresponding with both of us over the last week. And it's really refreshing to have some movie chats with the listeners. So thank you, Adam, for doing that. And everyone else, please follow Adam's lead.
Yeah, everyone else, you've been put on fucking call. So get your fingers out of your asses and start fucking corresponding.
Oh, you sound like me.
Yeah. It's rubbing off after all these years.
The other thing is from the corrections department. Chris, would you like to take this one?
Okay. So we had said, I think it was mostly me, had said that Tremors did not make our lists last episode for our 90s, neutered 90s, because we believed it came out in 1989.
Wait, we did not believe.
I did, I guess. And it did come out in 1990. So if you want to go back to my list, you could take off Nightbreed and throw some Tremors in there.
Oh, really?
I fucking love Tremors.
Nice, okay.
I would have had it on there for sure if I didn't get my years wrong. So oops.
All right, so Michelle, there you go. We apologize. All right, so let's get into what we've watched.
All right.
So I've got a few more this time as opposed to last time. So
kick it.
I'll get
but
the ball
don't lead with
here.
Shit.
Well,
that should be our mantra every time. Don't lead with shit. Don't lead with shit.
Well, okay, I'm gonna lead with the controversial title then.
Okay. Controversial wise, because everyone likes it and you don't?
I'm going to lead with Sharknado.
All right, the first one.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
So from 2013, everyone seems to know this movie, directed by Anthony C. Ferrante.
Yeah, it was a big phenomenon, and for some reason there's five of them.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen the first one.
Okay, so Anthony Ferrante had a background in special effects, and then he did a lot of work with The Asylum. And
he worked with Fango.
Yeah, so he's been around. So I did know that, and I did try watching Sharknado a few years ago, and I didn't like it very much at all. I turned it off probably after about 15 minutes. But I did give it another shot, and I'm sorry. I thought it was pretty fun.
It's not a good movie, but it is pretty fun.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
I don't see how they could have stretched it out to five movies, but
I'm actually kind of psyched to watch the other five movies.
I'm okay with the first one.
I didn't think I was going to like this at all. And you know what? When it started getting going and the like action scenes, as ridiculous as they were, I thought they were pretty engaging. I was actually kind of into it. I was surprised at the scope of some of the things, like the bus rescue.
The Ferris wheel.
I mean, yeah, there was a lot of bad CGI. There was a lot of like continuity, schmontinuity. Yep. But I thought Ian Ziering did a really good job in the lead role.
Well, you know, he had to. He was going up against Tara Reid. So
Tara Reid, she was a little.
She's awful.
She was a little bad, but it does seem like her character does go through some things throughout the series.
I liked some of the side characters more. I liked the daughter, and then that I think it was Australian, the Australian dude.
Baz.
Yeah, they were pretty good.
Jason Sims from Baywatch.
Yeah, they were pretty good.
Yeah, and that Nova girl, I thought she was pretty good too.
Yeah.
She was like the bartender or the waitress in the bar that like became a gun-toting action hero. So she was pretty good. And yeah, I thought it was really, really entertaining. And see, this is my thing with movies like this. Like, if this movie was not entertaining, it would have been fucking horrendous.
Yeah.
Which is often the time with Asylum titles. So that's why I was a little concerned about this one. But I thought it was really entertaining. I was, throughout the whole movie, I was fully into it, and I didn't think it got dull ever. And I really had a good time with this. I did think it was pretty funny that Steve Guttenberg was originally offered the lead role of Finn in this movie. Did you know that?
No, but it would have been a much better movie.
Yeah, and apparently the reason Steve Guttenberg is the star of Lavantula is because he was so pissed off that he turned down the role in Sharknado that I think he was like, oh, well, maybe this one will be a hit as well.
They should have called him Mahoney and Lavulantula. Just for all us.
Have you seen that one?
No.
There's some other Police Academy alumni in that as well.
Like who?
I think Leslie Easterbrook's in it.
Just fucking tell me Winslow's not in it.
I don't know if Winslow's
in it. If Winslow's in it, I'm fucking out.
We know.
I'm automatically out if Winslow's in it.
We know. Now, the other thing with Sharknado that I find quite annoying, and I think this is because I've just seen so many B-movies, that, you know, like, there's so many people that just say this is a piece of shit, it's the worst movie ever made, blah, 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 blah. If you go into IMDb and read the reviews, like, people are, like, genuinely pissed off. And I don't get it. Like, you're, like, seriously, you're watching a movie called Sharknado. Like, what are you expecting from this movie? And I thought it delivered exactly what you would kind of expect, especially if you know about the Asylum and sci-fi movies. But I thought it was perfectly fine, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I'm looking forward to checking out some of the sequels, because it does seem like they, at least judging by the poster art, looks like they get more ridiculous as the series wears on. So
yeah, it's Sharknado, I fully acknowledge, as being not a good movie in the sense of what a good movie is.
Yeah,
but I was entertained through the whole thing.
Yeah, and as far as like sci-fi shark movies go, this was way better than like Sharktopus and like Shark. What's that one? The Chris Ray one, Shark Week.
Two-headed Shark Attack?
No, I haven't seen Two-Headed Shark Attack, but Shark Week I did see, and I thought that was boring.
And sand sharks and
oh, there's so many, right?
Yeah.
And, but I thought this one really kind of delivered the goods as far as being a solid, entertaining, like, night at the movies. So, yeah, I really liked it. I mean, I'm not going to give it 5 stars or anything, but it certainly was fun. I'll give it that for sure.
But I feel like it's one of those movies where one and done. Like, I don't think this is a movie you'll ever revisit. Like, I don't feel like I'll ever revisit it particularly.
Yeah, I don't think I would either. I might one day. I think I'd maybe revisit other movies in the series, like, or maybe like a greatest hits.
Or maybe you'll just go on YouTube and watch the best clips.
Watch scenes, yeah. Like, I could see myself watching scenes from it again. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty fun. So there you go.
All right, well. Okay. Interesting kickoff, Josh.
Well,
Where do we go from there? How about we talk about Bubble Boy?
Yeah,
from Bubble 2001. Boy. A movie that I basically just picked up on the presumption of what the fuck is Jake Gyllenhaal doing in this movie. So this is from a little earlier in his career. It's made by Touchstone Pictures, which is a division of Disney.
Yeah.
And the story is he is born without an immune system and has to live in like a bubble oxygen tent kind of thing. And his mom, played by Susie Kurtz, who's super religious and super, like, germaphobe, keeps him in the house, and he kind of watches the world go by through his bedroom window. Hot girl moves in next door, played by Marley Shelton, who's the girl of his dreams. And he's like...
Oh, I like Marley Shelton.
She was in Rampage most recently.
She was barely in Rampage.
She's in Planet Terror.
Planet Terror, yeah.
And all those... Yeah. And she was in a movie called Sugar and Spice, which is like a cheerleader heist movie, which was okay.
Yeah, it's fun.
But So she's the girl next door that he kind of has a crush on, and then she befriends him, and they hang out in his room, and he's in his bubble, and she's not, and he finds out she's going to go off and be married in Las Vegas. So sure enough, he comes up with a way to become portable in his little bubble and goes on a fucking road trip to Vegas to try and find the girl of his dreams.
I'm totally
in. Of course you're in. So along the way, this being a road trip movie, he runs into, you know, a bunch of weird characters and gets into situations because he's a fish out of water. He's never been out of his house. Early on, he's trying to buy a bus ticket, and he has this exchange with the guy running the ticket booth, played by Zach Galifianakis, which just goes all over the place. Runs into Danny Trejo and his motorbike gang. They hang out for a bit. Runs into Vern Troyer, who runs a troupe of traveling freak shows, and hangs out with them for a bit, and then ends up in Vegas while his mom tries to track him down and stop him from being out in the big wide world. It's okay.
It sounds amazing.
It's okay. The problem is, it's just one of those early 2000s comedies like this, like the Touchstone put out. So there's this, there's like Frank McCluskey, PI, and, you know, It's Pat and Cabin Boy and all those kind of movies Touchstone put out in the mid-90s to the early 2000s, where they're just like, you watch them and you're like, they greenlit this, and I don't quite know why.
Yeah.
And this came out the same year as Donnie Darko.
Wow.
So I'm just like, what are you doing in this, Jake? Like, seriously, you're such a good actor. Why are you in Bubble Boy? So I guess that's one of the curiosity points for people who haven't seen it. His character in this just seems to be slow-witted for the most part.
Right.
Like, he just... the way he performs it, he gives him sort of like this hitching speech pattern, which kind of got on my nerves, to be honest.
Oh, that sounds bad, yeah.
And, you know, I thought Susie Kurtz was really fun as his super religious, like, mom, who she convinces him that he can't really eat a lot of regular food, so she keeps making him her special cookies, which are crosses. So that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
I mean, there's moments in this that I thought were okay, but, you know, it's like an 84-minute curiosity more than it is anything else.
Yeah.
And I know you'll watch it.
Because the great Betty Blowtorch is in it.
Yes, that's true. They do show up in this.
Yeah, so I do want to see that part.
But it's one of those ones where it's like, I watch it, I'm like, it wasn't bad, but it's nothing I'm going to like rush out and tell people to watch.
Yeah.
But if you're a little curious about where Jake Gyllenhaal started, Bubble Boy is definitely one you should see. I think if you're used to him being in like Oscar nominated performances, like, you know, Brokeback Mountain and Prisoners and stuff like that, you're in for a surprise. So yeah.
Great. All right.
And you're going to watch it.
What? I'm totally going to watch it. I'm absolutely going to watch it. You're absolutely correct. Okay. Next up, I watched the original Frankenstein because I haven't seen it in a while. Seen it many times, of course, but I am starting to work my way through the Universal horror movies slowly but surely. So this is from 1931, directed by James Whale, who also did Bride of Frankenstein and The Invisible Man. And this, I mean, it's a classic. I mean, what can you really say? It's the one Universal horror movie that I've gone back to the most over my life. I find it still holds up really well. I think Creature from the Black Lagoon also does. But I don't find Dracula holds up quite as well, or Wolfman. So this is definitely one I've gone back to. I go back to every few years. Colin Clive stars as Henry Frankenstein. And probably one of the best performances in classic horror that I can think of. He was just awesome and totally manic and yeah, just a really over the top performance, but believable. And yeah, definitely a really underrated actor for his time. Died quite young. Mae Clark plays Elizabeth, his bride to be, and. You might remember her if you're a fan of classic films. She was the receiving end of the grapefruit in Public Enemy, courtesy of James Cagney, a very, very famous scene. We also had Dwight Fry playing Fritz, who was, of course, Renfield in the original Dracula, and Edward Van Sloan, who was Van Helsing in the original Dracula, as well as he also was in The Mummy. And yeah, it's just a really, it's a short movie, but just beautiful cinematography, beautiful sets, awesome makeup on Boris Karloff by Jack Pierce. And yeah, an engaging story and, you know, with a very sympathetic monster. So I can't say enough good things about Frankenstein. If you haven't gone and checked out the Universal horror movies, I would highly recommend starting with this one or Creature from the Black Lagoon. I did do, as I was doing some research on this, I was a little bummed out though, because every time I'm down in California and I go on the Universal Studios tour, the little tram always goes by the Court of Miracles, which is like the little Europe set. And there's a big sign up there saying that this is where they shot Dracula and Frankenstein and all the old Universal horror movies. And I found out that that's a lie. So I'm quite pissed off about that. Apparently the original set burned down in the 60s and they've reconstructed it all. So what you're looking at is not the actual set. So I thought that was a bit of a bummer. And I still think they're saying that it's the same thing, which I find quite bizarre. It also made me want to visit Stage 12 at Universal because it's one of the biggest sound stages around, and it's where they shot all these movies and it's still standing. So I'd love to see that one day. So Universal horror, always great stuff, but I can't recommend this one enough.
Yeah, I think Creature is my favorite.
Yeah.
And I think I do like Bride a little bit better than the original Frankenstein.
I could never get into Bride.
Yeah, I think I like Bride a little bit better just because I like the more comedic tone of the sequel.
Right.
But this is obviously the movie where anyone who has a vision of Frankenstein in their head have the Carla Frankenstein in their head. Like, no doubt. Like, there's been other iterations of Frankenstein over the years, but when I think of Frankenstein, I think of that makeup.
Oh yeah,
Pierce's makeup. And I feel like the main performance, like the scientist performance, is the one that has been kind of put in as a template for mad scientists.
Oh yeah,
in every movie that's followed and has been parodied. I mean, even like I most recently was talking about Man with Two Brains.
Oh,
and even that performance is totally a takeoff.
Yeah,
of Frankenstein. Like,
yeah,
everything goes back to this movie, and you know, it's Universal. These are the classics, and if you haven't seen them, then you know you really should. You can get them for a really cheap price. You can get a big box set of them, and they're totally worth it.
Yeah, and they just announced a Blu-ray box set of the whole series too.
Yeah, I mean some of them are a little bit of a drag.
Yeah,
but you know, watch this, watch Bride, watch Creature, Wolfman, and Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
And never fear, I will let you know what they're all like over the next...
Oh, there you go.
Who knows how long.
All right.
So Colin Clive is totally underrated. And yep. Karloff's performance, I believe, is also totally underrated. He there's so many scenes in this where he's giving so much depth to this character that really shouldn't have a lot of depth. But that's what sells this movie. And just brilliant. So, yeah.
Well, and there was that... for the longest time, the lake scene...
Yeah.
Wasn't in this movie.
It was cut.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's probably the most effective scene in the entire thing.
Yeah, it's definitely
for the most part
memorable, for sure, yeah.
And that was cut for the longest time, so I'm glad that actually made its way back into the film.
I agree.
Yeah. So, was this one, were you doing two this time?
I am doing two this time.
We did come up with a game plan of how many we would do to get it proper, so.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So listener Adam also gave us some recommendations, so I decided to take him up on one.
All right.
And it was described to me as Die Hard in a Mall, so I was immediately like, sold. So I decided to give it a shot, and it's called Security from 2017, directed by Alain Desrochers. French director, done a lot of low-budget stuff. Most known, the title that jumped out at me was he did the Bon Cop Bad Cop 2 sequel to the original that came out last year. I also noticed that it was produced by Avi Lerner and Boaz Davidson, who are both known names. But I think Boaz Davidson did Last American Virgin, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so.
I have to fact check myself on that.
But those are the guys who, I think they form New Image.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s. Yeah. And New Image was kind of like a successor to Canon. Like in the 90s, there was PM Entertainment and there was New Image.
Right.
And New Image were the guys who brought all the people from Canon on board. Like they had Sam Furstenberg directing stuff. And, you know, they had David Bradley in like movies like Cyborg Cop and stuff like that. And these guys were responsible for producing
all kinds of awesomeness.
Yeah, I think New Image also had something to do with the 2008 Rambo, if I'm correct.
Did they?
Or Millennium. I think Millennium's their new company.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have to look into, like, if Boaz did this or not, but I can't see my my Blu-ray.
Well, I will get out my phone.
There it is.
You talk about the film.
There it is. Filler.
Everybody
filler,
go buy filler. The Arrow Video Blu-ray of Last American Virgin.
Of course it doesn't say right on the cover.
I will find out for you.
Anyway,
just talk.
I will continue. Okay, so as I kind of suspected, Antonio Banderas is quite the badass, and I think he really is inventing himself as in this new kind of role as this like kind of grizzled, older, tough guy dude. And so it does kind of tie into the episode a little bit. So he's this, you know, this veteran of the army that's, did you find it?
Keep going.
This army vet that can't find a job. So, but he's really down on his luck. So he eventually ends up getting a job at a mall as a security guard. Unbeknownst to him, the same night he got the job as the mall security guard, there happened to be a witness to a crime. This little girl who was on her way to testify, and the convoy that was taking her to like the courthouse to testify got taken out by the bad guys led by Ben Kingsley, and so she got away and beeline to the mall while the rest of the FBI people that were taking care of her got taken out. So she gets to the mall. Antonio's just started his job. He lets her in. And then, soon, you know, 5 minutes later, Ben Kingsley's at the door saying, basically, hand over the girl or you're dead. And then there proceeds to become a siege movie in this mall. Do you have some info?
He did direct it.
Yes. All right. So,
and he is one of the co-founders with Lerner of Millennium Films, and they have made so many movies, you know.
Yeah.
They even made the Expendables series.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah, he's an interesting cat. Okay, so we're at the mall that's under siege, and then a bunch of action scenes happen. So I thought on the surface this was a good premise, and I could have been really into this. My issue with this movie is the mall did not seem like a mall. Like, it felt like... So this all happens at night, for starters. So fair enough. I love Dawn of the Dead, whatever. Deserted mall, great. But it didn't look like a mall. Like, it looked so much like a set. Like, I couldn't take it seriously. Like, it was really, really strange the way the set design in this movie was done. Because it all looked kind of like... It looked like the whole thing looked like it was set in, like... a really bad Sears, like, department store. Like, and it, you know, like, there was a food court, but, like, it was, like one counter with, like, five stools in front of it. That was the food court. And, like, there was a shoe store, and it literally would say something like shoe store. And, like, everything was painted, like, very basically. There was, it was, like, so lazy. I was just, like, it felt like play acting in like a elementary school play or something. It was really, really strange, but it really prevented me from kind of getting into the movie. Then the other thing that was preventing me from getting into the movie was that some of the other security guards were like clear, like comic relief. So like we had like his boss, who was like this like kind of like washed up jock guy who, like, you know, his you know, football career never took off, and now he's ended up as a security guard, but he's the boss, so of course he's like a total dick, and he's got like big sideburns, and he's just one of those like loudmouth jock guys, but it was played for comedy, and So that was like, oh shit. Then we had like, you know, this like kind of meek guy who, and he was played by one of the guys from the Last House on the Left remake, Chad Lindbergh. And, you know, he was kind of played as the kind of like wimpy guy who like doesn't know what to do. And then we've got this little girl running around everywhere who's like totally not behaving herself, that's like creating all this havoc. And it just, what could have been a really cool movie, I felt just kind of fell flat because I just wasn't buying into any of it. So really unfortunate. There were a few decent action scenes. I will say the action was okay in this. And Antonio looked great, and he looked great, like, you know, firing off two guns and jumping around and all that. And I thought he looked great. But yeah, just overall, I just really wish they had paid a little more attention to like the location, because it just killed it for me. So that's my biggest beef with this.
So, question.
that was a big sigh.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out when you're talking about. You said it's set at nighttime.
Yes.
Is the mall open?
No.
Then why is there a little girl running around?
Because Antonio lets her in.
Okay, that's what I was confused about.
Because she's knocking at the door like, help, help, help. So he lets her in. And then they lock the door, and then Ben Kingsley shows up.
So this is a different girl than the one that was on the run from Ben Kingsley?
No, she's the one that was on the run.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. I thought it was like a grown woman that they were chasing.
No, no, no.
Oh, okay.
It's a little girl.
That's annoying then.
It's a little girl. Yeah.
And Ben Kingsley is the bad guy, and he wasn't awesome?
Ben Kingsley's a good bad guy, but Ben Kingsley is also like primary like candidate for my theory about great British actors slumming it, because I think they all do it. You know, there are always like these great British actors that could have these amazing careers that pick like the weirdest shit that just totally undermines their capabilities.
Which underrated episode was it that Vince and I were after you about that? Was it the 90s one?
About the British actors?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, was I going on about that?
Yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah. One of the underrated episodes, me and Vince were naming you actors that were British that went against your theory, and you kind of was like, yeah, okay, that's
Oh, really? Well, you can't think of any right now, can you?
Well, not off the top of
my
head.
Yeah, see?
All right.
But Ben Kingsley, like, how did he go from Gandhi to this? And Antonio looks way better with short hair, you know? I mean, I know he had an action past with, like, Desperado and you know, Assassins and movies like that, but
Zorro
I thought he was great in Zorro, and then I don't know what kind of happened, but I do kind of like the way he's reinventing himself. I just hope he doesn't go the way of like Nicolas Cage, where he's like showing up in like every like Netflix action movie.
Isn't he also in that Bullethead movie from this year, the Paul Solit
one? Got like three or four this year. I think he could be really good, but I think he's got to be careful. I think he could be really kick-ass, but if he could just be in everything, right?
I think, Josh, that this movie would have been much more awesome if perhaps it would have been filmed when the Galleria was still open.
Yeah, or had it been filmed in a fucking mall. Yeah. But this mall set, dude, I can't even describe it, but if you see it, you'll be like, what the hell? Like, I couldn't get myself... my brain away from that. So there you go. Security.
All right. Well, then I'm going to get the weird one out of the way. Weird in the sense that it's not a movie that we would normally talk about on this show, but fuck it. I talked about Brave Little Toaster last episode.
Yes, you did.
So I'm going to go with and talk about Stick It from 2006 this fucking episode. Okay.
Okay. Well, no one knows what Stick It is. That's okay.
Well, yeah, maybe. This is a movie that's written and directed by Jessica Bendinger, who wrote Bring It On, which we were talking about earlier tonight, because Josh has it in his head that he might want to watch that entire series. I told him he better not fucking talk about it on the podcast. But I guess because I'm talking about Stick It, you get a pass. And if you really want to, you can.
I don't know if I could do the Bring It On series.
So this is a movie where I went into it. I knew going in that it was like kind of a movie aimed at teenage girls who liked Bring It On. It was set in the world of competitive gymnastics. It was like a comedy, kind of drama. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this, but I paid $1 for it. Jeff Bridges is in it. Why the fuck not? I liked it.
I liked it too.
I thought it was quite... You watched it?
Yeah, it's all a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
Years ago, yeah.
It's quite entertaining.
Yeah.
And so basically it's about this girl called Haley who's the super rebellious type, played by Missy Peregrine, who I really loved in the movie Backcountry a few years ago.
Okay,
yeah. And she was in the TV show Rookie Blue.
Right.
She's a Canadian actress.
Yeah.
She grew up in Surrey, BC, which is close to here. And I really liked her in this movie, too. I didn't like how they tried to give her the rebellious cred by having her wearing, like, Bad Brains t-shirts and Ramones t-shirts and stuff like that. I was kind of like, I'm not quite buying that part of you,
right,
Haley, sorry. But, you know, you were hanging out with skateboard dudes and, yeah, you know, you were getting into mischief. So, okay, I buy part of your rebellious. So she gets in trouble and she gets sent to this, like, gym. Kind of a gymnastics thing because she was a world-class gymnast who dropped out of the competition for qualifying for the Olympics because she was, like, you know, pissed off. So she gets sent to this gym headed by Jeff Bridges, who was this former Olympian who's washed up and hurt himself and is trying to, you know, he's not that great really as a coach, but they sent him there so she can reform. So she ends up, you know, learning how she loves gymnastics again. Jeff Bridges, she starts to like him, even though he's a bit of a dick at first. And they go compete in the big competition at the end.
Yeah.
That's the basic story of it.
Sports movie plot 101.
Exactly. So I actually did like this quite a bit. I thought that the lead was really good. I thought Bridges didn't look too embarrassed to be here.
Yeah.
Which I was expecting because I'm like, what are you doing in this? And then I remembered that about, you know, 7 years after this, he was in RIPD, and I was like, okay, fine. It's fine. I thought that it was actually a way better directed film than I was expecting because there's some style in this thing. Like, there's moments in this where they're doing their routines, and it's, like, super visually, like, arresting because they have this scene where... No, I'm not kidding. Wow. I'm not kidding. Like, there's a scene where they're all doing their routines, and it's shot from, like, overhead and the sides and that, but they've blended all the routines together so they overlap with each other. So it makes this kind of mosaic kind of thing. And I was like, that's really cool. Like, I've never seen that in this kind of movie before, and it's really well shot, and it's surprisingly artistic in a way. And I'm like, that doesn't belong in this movie, but I really dig it.
Nice.
So there was that kind of stuff. Like I said, the cast was fun. There's some funny jokes. Bridges doesn't embarrass himself. He doesn't look embarrassed. And I just found it to be just a really entertaining routine by the book kind of ride. If you like sports comedies, you'll like Stick It for sure. The only thing I found weird was when I went on Letterboxd after to rate it and was looking at the reviews on there like I tend to after I finish watching something. And I don't know how long this has been a thing or why this is a thing, but there's a lot of people commenting saying, this is the movie that made me gay. This is the movie that turned me into a lesbian. This made me like girls. And I'm like, where are they getting that from? Because when I was watching this movie, I wasn't getting the vibes that this would be the kind of movie that would make girls be like, I'm having a sexual awakening.
Yeah.
Like,
I do know about that reputation with,
like,
this movie.
Like, where did it come from?
I'm not sure. Maybe is a director a lesbian?
I don't know, but I just find it really weird. I mean, it's a movie about gymnasts, so of course there's going to be young girls in tights and stuff. It's gym. It's gymnastics. So what? But everyone's like, oh, when she took that ice bath, I knew I was a lesbian instantly. Because there's a scene where she takes an ice bath because she's all sore.
An ice bath?
Well, there's no nudity. It's PG-13. But she's taking an ice bath because she's been doing routines and it helps her joints and everything. But it was like, oh my God, I knew I was a dyke after that and everything. I'm like, huh?
Wow.
So okay. I found that to be really confusing.
Yeah.
But I do recommend this movie if you like those kind of like sports comedies. Like, I liked Bring It On too, so I'm not going to say they're guilty pleasures because I don't feel guilty for liking them.
Yeah.
But I didn't know you liked it because when I brought it over last time and you saw the cover, you're like, nope.
Well, because I've seen it.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you had seen it. So you actually thought it was pretty good too.
Yeah, it was definitely not one I was like, oh, I need to watch this again. But
yeah,
But yeah.
But it's a fun ride when you're watching it.
Yeah, it's good. It was good. Yeah.
All right.
But very, yeah, like by the book. But yeah. I mean, I like movies like that too. So.
Yeah. And I just think having a fun young cast and like I said, having some shots in it that I wasn't expecting and stuff.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a good way to spend an evening. So yeah. Stick it.
Like I watched that Winning Season. You left that here.
Yeah, that was pretty good
Sam
too.
Rockwell one.
Yeah.
But same thing, right? Like it's nothing great, but it's just kind of a fun, you know what you're getting, and sometimes you just kind of want
I kind of like that one, too.
Yeah,
that was a good one. That was Sam Rockwell as an alcoholic high school basketball coach of a girls' team, just in case anyone's
wondering.
Rooney
Mara was in it, too.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah, it's good.
All right, so yeah, I kind of recommend Stick It, got to admit.
Kind of recommend. That was solid.
I do recommend.
Okay, good.
It's just I'm trying to play to our audience, and I'm sure there's people out there going, what the fuck is wrong with you right now?
No, I think it's a good pick, man. I don't think people would know about that movie.
Yeah, maybe not.
Right? What's that beeping? Okay, it stopped. Okay. All right, I went to the theater.
The theater?
Yes, the theater.
Oh, my goodness.
And I kind of went to the theater not really wanting to go to the theater.
Oh, forced theater.
But I went anyway, because that's what I do.
Yeah, you're weird that way.
Why?
Because you'd be like, you'll just go.
Well, I just like going. And okay, some, you know, you don't.
How
like
are
I,
you forced to go?
I also don't like. I don't like judging movies before I've seen.
But like, how were you forced to go?
Well, you know, just people ask me if I want to go, and I'm like, sure, I'll go.
And you didn't have any interest in whatever you're about to talk about.
Yeah, but I'll sometimes just go. I mean,
all right. Well, what is it?
It's Jurassic World: Fallen Kingdom.
Okay.
So the reason I was kind of like, eh, is because I thought Jurassic World was pretty eh.
I haven't seen it, so
yeah, I didn't like it very much. So, I mean, I didn't hate it, but I was just kind of like, eh, you know, whatever. Like,
yeah, but dude, this has Goldblum.
Sort of. So anyway, after the first one, I was just kind of like, okay, Chris Pratt's pretty cool. I mean, I like him and everything. I didn't like, what's her name? Bryce Dallas Howard. I just didn't really care for the first movie. I just wasn't what I was expecting. I was really excited because of the trailer, and it just didn't deliver kind of what I had hoped it would. So when I went into this one, I was just kind of like, eh, whatever. I'll go. Sure. But I'll tell you, man, I really dug this.
Really?
I thought it was a really solid summer action movie. Not a great movie, but kind of like Sharknado. Let me rephrase that. But it wasn't kind of like Sharknado, but it was entertaining like that. Like it was one of these movies where it just, you know, within the first few minutes, it kicks off and then it's pretty much action through the whole movie. And you're just into it through the whole movie. It went by very fast. Chris Pratt's really fun. The different set pieces were all really, really cool. The dinosaurs looked great. I really liked the premise of this, which is kind of like a dinosaur slavery idea. The trailer kind of focused a lot on like the first third of the movie. So it didn't really give too much away. So I didn't really know what to expect, which is always a good thing. Ted Levine was in it, and I didn't even really recognize him, but played a really great bad guy. James Cromwell showed up. Better story, better characters. There was a little kid in it that wasn't annoying. Sorry, that sounded terrible. I love kids, but oftentimes in movies, they can really wreck movies, especially in big budget action movies. And I thought the kid in this movie was great. Yeah, I mean, the only issue I had with it is I just never really felt there was, I never felt stakes for the characters. Like I never was like, oh God, is Chris Pratt going to die? And I kind of like that sense of danger. Like I think you kind of need that, but I felt through this whole movie, like everyone's pretty much safe except for the bad guys. I kind of like it when they just throw in like a totally like out of left field death right off the bat, which sets you off kilter. But I think, so this was clearly made for kids a little more. And I just kind of wish there was a little bit more of an edge to it that way. So the suspense scenes would have been amped up a little bit more if I felt like something could actually happen to someone. It also set up for a sequel that actually makes me actually want to see the sequel. So yeah, I thought it was really good. I can't remember who directed it. Colin Trevorrow? I think that's his name, who directed the first one. This was directed by J.A. Bayona, who's actually a Spanish director who did The Orphanage, which was a really cool horror movie from about 10 years ago. So I was quite surprised that he did it. He also did a movie called A Monster Calls, which I can't remember if you saw that. I thought you had given that a good review.
That's a really good movie.
Yeah, so it kind of, you know, and again, this kind of goes by, like, you know, what we talk about with, like, these, you know, kind of independent directors getting these big movies, and oftentimes they're not equipped to do it. But I felt like this guy, especially with those two movies in his resume, I felt like he was a really good choice, and he did seem to really understand pacing and stuff like that. So, yeah, I thought Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom was really good and not expecting to at all. So if you weren't too into Jurassic World, the first one, I'd recommend you check this one out, because it's quite different. And yeah, if you're looking for a big summer action movie, I haven't been as up on them as I normally am, but this was a great way for me to start the summer with a movie like this, because they're getting harder and harder to get good ones, I find, these days.
I haven't seen the first, like, Jurassic World, the first Pratt one, but I do like him.
Yeah.
The only thing that I saw about this one is, like, I've seen, like, commercials and trailers for this, and I just get the impression that it's kind of like Lost World, Jurassic Park 2, in the sense that they've transplanted the dinosaurs to, like, urban centers, like houses and stuff, like they rampaging through a city. And I don't know if I'm correct in that.
No.
But that's the impression I was getting, and that's kind of why I'm kind of like, I don't know if I want that, because I didn't like Jurassic Park 2 because of that.
Yeah. No, it's not like
that. Okay, that's good, because I was kind of like, I don't know. I didn't really like... I'm one of those people who like Jurassic Park 3 better than 2.
I did too.
Yeah. And I'm like, and I know that I'm in a minority on that one.
Really?
Yeah.
I hated 2 when it came out.
I didn't like 2, because I feel like 3 was more along the lines of what I want from a fucking dinosaur movie, to be honest.
Yeah.
Like pterodactyls, for shit's sake.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I want. You know, but for some reason, I just haven't got around to Jurassic World yet, and maybe I should.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, if you watch that one, you might be like, dude, what are you talking about? But the sequel was very good.
Well, it's like I said, I really liked The Monster Calls, so
yeah.
It's weird that he would make this big budgeted action movie, but that's the trend, you're right.
Yeah.
But what about Goldblum?
Goldblum wasn't in it very much.
Ah, it's too bad.
Very, very minimal.
That's too bad.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is kind of sold like he's in it a lot, but no, it's very, very...
Everyone loves Goldblum.
It's a cameo.
But everyone loves Goldblum from the original. Come on.
They do, yeah. Yeah.
All right, cool.
Okay, moving... How many more do you have left?
I have 2.
You have 2.
So this is your double up again.
Oh, it is, though. God, there's so many. Wow. Okay, I watched, from our friends at Arrow, Brain Damage.
Nice.
Frank Henenlotter's 1988 weirdo movie.
Elmer!
This is one that when I originally saw it, I didn't like it at all. And
I have to agree with you on that. Like, out of the 3 big ones for Henenlotter, like Brain Damage, Frankenhooker, and Basket Case, this was my least favorite.
Yeah. I've never seen the Basket Case movies, and I saw Frankenhooker when I was a teenager, so I don't remember it at all.
I have a look of shock on my face right now.
I know. But I saw Brain Damage first time in tape trading, and I remember I got my hands on an uncut copy, and I think it's just another one of these where you see it on Blu-ray versus a shitty washed out tape, and it's a completely different experience. And I'm not going to say I loved this movie, but it certainly had a real punk rock feel to it. It was shot in New York in the late 80s, and it definitely had, that's the best way I can describe it. It felt like this kind of really kind of indie DIY horror movie that was a lot of fun. Premise is that movie opens with this old couple that have lost something in their apartment that was living in the bathtub. They go on this frantic search for their apartment that was really quite frenetic, and like they were like literally tearing the shit out of this apartment. It really kind of got me into this kind of like overhyped sensibility. And then we soon find out that what they've lost is this parasite creature that has attached itself to a neighboring apartment dweller named Brian. And he has this thing attached to his head, and he wakes up with blood on the back of his head and realizes that there's this parasite living on him, and it starts talking to him, and it's just really weird, and it's this strange puppet, and it's
Almer, dude.
Its name is Almer, and it sings and chats with him, and has a thirst for blood, and it also injects him with some sort of drug to make him like hallucinate in really trippy, weird 80s style colors, and they're really quite interesting, or well, not interesting, psychedelic, I guess would be the best word for the scenes where he's kind of tripping out. Like, it's very, very colorful and an acid trip. So he goes off to, like, you know, he's high on this drug that Almer's giving him, but Almer's like, well, if you give me this drug, you basically need to get me some blood. So off they go, and Almer, they run into different people, and Almer basically attacks the people and sucks out their blood. And there's some pretty memorable kills here. There's a great scene in a junkyard. There's, of course, infamous fellatio scene which features Almer, and there's also a great nightmare scene where he's like pulling Brian's like pulling his brains out of his ear, and it's very graphic, and the effects are quite good and pretty cool. There's some great scenes of walking around in New York, it's particularly down St. Mark's Place. Like, you even get to see like the infamous Manic Panic store in one of the shots. There's a pretty fun scene in a restaurant where they're eating, and he looks down, and the spaghetti is all like, the meatballs all look like brains that are all like screaming, and it's a very creative movie. And it's also got some really weird scenes, which I also always love in movies. Like, there's one scene in a shower where there's like big muscle guy like taking a shower, and there's not really any reason for him to be there. And then there's a great toilet attack, and a really, really cool basket case reference in the subway. I don't know if you remember that, where the lead character from Basket Case is actually on the subway.
Yeah,
so that was pretty cool. So I mean, I get the appeal of Helen Lauder. Just a really really, like, kind of reminds me of like the Penelope Spheeris early days, just that real kind of aesthetic of just not really having a lot of money, but being really creative and making something really unique and interesting. Also reminded me a lot of like the cinema of transgression, like the like early Richard Kern movies or Nick Zed movies, and which would make sense. You know, they're all being punks out of New York. So yeah, I'd really recommend checking this one out. Arrow's done, as usual, a great job in this. There's like a 50-minute documentary. There's commentary tracks. There's interviews, all kinds of stuff. So definitely worth a pickup and a huge, huge upgrade from what I've been used to. So do you have any memories of Brain Damage?
Out of the Helen Lauder movies, of those three, it is my least favorite. Mm-hmm. But it's been a long time since I've seen it.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of subversive stuff in this movie that I might not have picked up on back in the VHS days that I would probably get now.
Yeah.
I feel like it's one of those movies. Personally, Frankenhooker's my favorite of his.
Yeah.
And probably always will be.
Yeah.
I still remember the talking VHS box of Frankenhooker, obviously.
Yeah.
Want a date?
Yeah.
But he's an interesting cat. He always... Like, Helen Lauder always tries to do something different.
Yeah.
And having that, like, especially being that he made most of his films in the 80s New York, that's awesome for me because we love 80s New York. Like, we just love the feel and the look of 80s New York. And it's super prevalent in Basket Case, obviously, because that's, like, 1982 New York. And that's, like, you know, 42nd Street, like, Skid Row kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But he does a good job of making us feel how shitty New York was in the 80s in certain areas.
Yeah.
And I really like that about his movies, but Brain Damage, one that I actually think I need to pick up and give a shot, another chance to, because Arrow's release of Frankenhooker is really good.
Yeah.
And I've heard that their re-release of Basket Case is a really great release also. So I might have to check it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with this director, that, well, at least for with this movie, is that if you like your movies polished, you're not going to like this movie.
Yeah, no.
But if you can deal with like it being pretty, you know, lo-fi, then I think it's got a lot to offer.
I think the outrageousness of his movies more than makes up for him being lo-fi.
Yeah, yeah. So. Lots of yelling in this movie, too. But yeah, the lead guy I thought was great. He sort of reminded me of Bruce Campbell in a weird way, but yeah, it was a lot of fun. So, brain damage.
I just remember Almer being kind of like singing show tunes.
Yeah, he did. He did have a theme song he sang.
Yeah,
I can't remember what it was.
Oh, it's too bad you didn't remember, because then I would have made you sing it.
No, he was in the sink singing something about himself. Yeah, this is a very unique movie. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about another film that was filmed in New York State, and it's a movie I was really curious about watching, and I finally decided, since it popped up on one of these free streaming services I have on my Roku, to give it a shot. It's a 2016 movie called Model Hunger.
Right.
Directorial debut for Debbie Rochon, who, if any of you know her, we know she's been in over 200 B-movies, a lot of them of very low quality, but some really good, like American Nightmare is a really good one that she's in, where she's awesome. Josh talked about Santa Claus, which he's in. Maybe not so awesome, but he's in it. And, you know, we respect Debbie Rochon quite a bit on this show. We talked about her in our Scream Queens episode a little bit as well.
Yeah.
And so I'd always been curious about A Model Hunger, because I was like, she's directing a movie. That'll be interesting. And I hate to say that the results didn't please me that much. I was quite disappointed. Lynn Lowry stars in this, and she's from the Romero's The Crazies in 73. She was in Shivers, Cronenberg Shivers. She's had kind of a resurgence. I Drink Your Blood, yes, I'm credited. I Drink Your Blood. And she's had kind of a resurgence in the last 10 years, showing up in more indie horror movies and stuff like that, showing up at conventions. And so she plays a former model who's living in kind of like suburban New York. And, you know, the thing is that she's a cannibal now. So she's either girls are showing up at her door to sell her cookies or do fundraising and get killed, or she goes out looking for girls hitchhiking and brings them back home and kills them and eats them. That's basically what she does. At the same time, she spends a lot of her time watching some weird show on public access television, which is like championing obesity and like body image and stuff. And it's just this weird thing where the host is like dressed in a wig and talking about positivity, and then they cut to scenes of like a really overweight, cross-dressing, divine looking character just like trying to be erotic and rubbing themselves. And there's a scene in the movie where people are watching that and getting sexually aroused, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on in this movie right now?
Yeah.
And and then there's like scenes of Lowry's character basically torturing these girls, and it's really tightly shot gore scenes, which some of them are okay, but most of them are shot so tight that I was like, I don't know what's going on with these either.
Right.
You've got a lot of inner monologue by Lowry's character, I dislike inner monologue in these kind of movies, because most of it is just an opportunity for the character to say foul things and try and be shocking. And, you know, I don't need their innermost thoughts. What's more scary to me in a movie that's about a killer, especially a killer who's a serial killer and a cannibal, would be less descriptors, which I've talked about in the past. You know, why does Carpenter's Halloween work the most? Because you don't know much about it. That's why Rob Zombie's didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and I find that that's just stuff I don't really need. And I thought it was poorly done in this. I thought that it was shot poorly. I mean, I know it's shoestring budget, so I am forgiving it for some of that. But when you can't keep your camera still, like when your camera's shaking about a lot, it's really distracting.
Yeah.
And I, you know, like invest in like a tripod or something, right? Like, like that kind of was bothering. The plot's very minimal, and it's just badly framed a lot of times. Like there'll be a scene where Lowry's character has picked up a girl and they're driving in the car back to her place, having a conversation, and the close-ups are so tight on the actors that you're just like, this isn't working for me. It's not a very well-directed film. Okay? Yeah. And I hate to say it because I do love Debbie Rochon and I do like what she stands for. And I do really respect the fact that she's worked in the industry since the 80s.
Yeah.
But this just didn't do it for me, dude. It just didn't.
Oh, it's too bad.
Like,
yeah.
You've got Tiffany Shepis playing her, this neighbor who just moved in, who has her own mental problems, who gets suspicious of her, but they never utilize her to an advantage that works.
Yeah.
So it's like you're wasting Tiffany Shepis. You're not really making your movie that, you know, like your movie's not very well made. And it just seems to be trying to shock for this. It just seems to be trying to shock for the sense of being shocking rather than actually trying to make something that, like, you're preaching a body positivity message to me, but at the same time, you're kind of throwing the most foul shit you can think of at me and trying to be gory, and it's kind of muddying your message of what you're trying to do, which shouldn't really be in this type of movie to begin with.
Right.
And it's a mess.
Ah, yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say. Lowry, however, is pretty great.
Yeah?
I got to give her credit. If there's any reason to watch this movie, it's for her.
Okay.
So she's really good in this. It's just unfortunate that what's around her just didn't work for me.
Oh, it's too bad.
Yeah, so that's Model Hunger, and unfortunately, I can't say I recommend it.
Yeah, yeah. So. All right, well...
that's the only bummer I have
this
time.
Let's go from that body image movie to a movie I watched that...
it just has a lot of bodies in it.
Completely kicks that in the face. And
oh,
that
is
would
it a
be,
sex comedy?
Well, it is, you know, fucking summer starting.
Yeah.
So the stupid heat's going to start soon and everyone's going to be sweating and yay.
My body's wet.
So I thought, what better way to get into summer than to watch a summer movie to maybe...
My body's so dripping wet.
Okay.
That's my hot t-shirts reference.
Yeah. Because everyone's getting that one.
Fuck yeah. Chuck Vincent, 1979, hot t-shirts. Watch it.
We watched it.
And it was great.
It was great.
Anyway.
Okay, so... Yeah, just to try and like improve my mood in these days.
You hate the summer, don't you?
I really am not a fan. well, I mean, there's parts of it I like. I like it in small doses.
I just hate the summer when it gets to like plus 30 degrees out. That's when I hate the summer.
Yeah, I like it when it's like, you know, 5 days of sun and then a couple days of rain.
All right.
But I don't like this like 30 days of like fucking heat. Yeah, I can fuck off.
All right.
Anyway, okay. Wow, Debbie Downer over here. Anyway, to try and get myself in the mood, I decided to watch Hard Bodies from 1984.
Oh, yeah.
From director Mark Griffiths.
All right.
And yeah, I mean, it opens up with a bikini montage and an 80s theme and yep. Venice Beach and. Yep. Yeah, I was pretty into it pretty quickly. I don't remember this movie very much. I do remember seeing it at some point in my life, but I did not remember
and
much.
You remember the plot because it's the plot of 40,000 sex comedies in the 80s.
I don't know if I've seen a lot of this plot.
I have.
Really? So the plot is based on a true story that appeared in... I think some magazine, Playboy or something. No, maybe it wasn't Playboy. Anyway, some magazine. And it was a true story about these three older dudes who rented a beach house in California and enlisted a young surfer dude to sort of teach them how to get chicks. That's basically the plot, which I don't remember. Where else
have
you seen
that? I just
mean
like the plot of like someone getting like a young hot guy to help them snare chicks.
Oh, okay.
That's the kind of plot I'm talking about. Like, that's in a lot of these movies.
That is in a lot of these movies, yeah.
I'm not talking about particularly three old dudes doing it. I'm just talking the plot of having, oh, there's that hot guy on the beach. Let's get him to teach us how to get women.
Yeah, yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So this one does have, yeah, these three dudes, and they're trying to get laid, and they're being unsuccessful. So they see this guy named Scotty, and they're like, wow, this guy is like a chick magnet. Like, basically, he's like, decides he's cleaning one of their cars one day and takes it out for a spin and comes back, and he's got like five chicks. And they're all like, oh, my God, this guy's amazing. So they decide that they want to get Scotty to help them get women and Scotty's kind of like method of doing this is he says you always got to like go to women, you always got to promise them the bigger, better deal. And that's how you get them. You always got to tell them that you can get them something better than what they've already got. And that's his theory, and it seems to be working great for them. And then these older dudes start doing it, and it starts working great for them. And then, yeah, the whole movie is pretty much about that. At one point, of course, you know, they part ways with Scotty, and then there's of course a huge party at the end where all kinds of hijinks ensue and Scotty's relationship's in trouble, blah 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 blah. So we've got all these like dramatic plot points going on as well, but overall, yeah, this is just kind of a classic 80s sex comedy, and it's really is a lot of fun. I mean, it's a classic for a reason. I mean, sexist as hell, but it is what it is, and it is a movie of the time. The guy who played Scotty was Grant Kramer, who was also in Killer Clowns from Outer Space. Teal Roberts, who played Christy, his girlfriend, she hasn't really done much, which I'm surprised at, but she was the lead in Fatal Games, which is, I don't know if you've seen it yet.
Have seen it, yeah.
I really want to see it. It's the slasher movie about a javelin
thrower. It's okay. A little slow, but it's pretty good.
Yeah. This is some great, like real 80s things going on. And there's like a waterbed that shoots lasers and has smoke, and it's in the shape of a car.
Dude, you remember fucking waterbeds?
Did
you ever have a waterbed?
I really want a waterbed.
I had one. They suck.
You had one?
Yeah, dude.
Why don't you have one? Why doesn't anyone have one anymore?
Because they're terrible.
But they seem so awesome. Like, it just seems like it'd be so cool to have a waterbed.
You know, okay, let's talk about something a little bit personal. Waterbeds are not good to have sex on.
Why?
They just aren't, dude. You try and, like, get in position, and your fucking knee slips because the water's sloshing on your knee, and you fucking hit your head on the side rail. You're like, fuck this waterbed. All I want to do is have sex.
Sink on the floor or something?
Basically. Or you go on the edge where there's the wooden part.
Really?
Yeah, dude. They suck.
I totally didn't want to picture that.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. But they suck.
Really? Aren't they comfortable to sleep on?
Not really. Because you'll be like rolling on them, and then you'll roll, and you'll wake up in the morning, and you're wedged between the fucking waterbed mattress part and the edge of the bed that's holding it in, and you're wedged there, and you're like, fuck, I can't move.
I guess when you really think about it.
They were a terrible fucking trend.
And when you think about it, it's probably not very good for your back either.
No, they're a terrible trend, dude.
Yeah, but...
You're just like, I'm sure they're fucking awesome.
I've totally romanticized them.
You shouldn't have. They were shit.
I didn't have one. I wasn't like Mr. Hoity-Toity over here.
I inherited mine somehow. I think like...
Anyone have a waterbed anymore?
I don't think they make them anymore. There might be some dude who has a mullet and drives around in a fucking van with a Boris... painting on the side who has one still or something.
Oh, dude, imagine a van with a Boris painting on the side with a waterbed in the back.
Holy that would be shit.
Yeah.
Okay, I might take back my waterbed bad comments if that happened. Do you imagine if you had like a Boris painted van with a waterbed in the back and you were dealing drugs out the front like Rock and Roll High School?
Yeah.
And then all the trim would come along and you'd be like, hey, baby. Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay, you sold.
Okay.
This is like an early 80s, late 70s van movie we're talking about
now. I think...
Yeah. Like super van.
Or that other movie, that Malibu High movie. The drug dealer in that totally should have had a waterbed.
But did he have a Boris painted van?
No, he didn't have a Boris painted van, but he seemed like the kind of dude that would have a waterbed in the back. But because he was also a pimp.
Was it shag carpeted in the back?
It was shag carpeted, oh,
okay.
I believe.
Okay. But this is a bit of a tangent.
And I really do want to kind of research waterbeds now. Like, what happened to waterbeds?
They were shit. That's what fucking happened.
I get that. But I mean, you just think, you know, some of that shit. Stuff from the past has come back.
They probably had this thing where it was like all of a sudden all these people, surgeons showed up on like 60 Minutes being like, waterbeds are bad for you. Don't sleep on them.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but this is going to have to be my
They give you VD.
This is going to have to be my weekend project. And the other thing is
the
waterbed in this shot lasers and smoke, and it had a disco ball.
Oh, see, that sounds
and
okay.
And it actually
where did the laser shoot
it
from?
Had a feature where it would make waves in the bed for you. Yeah, it would look fucking epic, man.
That might make getting down a little
easier. I don't know. Like, they pushed the horn, because it also...
There's a horn?
It was like...
Like the...
No, it was like a waterbed, like, in a kind of a car type, like, bed setting.
What?
So, like, there was actually a steering wheel at the head of the waterbed, and, like, buttons you could push, and, like, you pushed one button, and, like, smoke would come out. You pushed another button, and, like, these waves would start. You pushed another button, the disco ball started going, and lasers would come out.
Okay, it was fucking awesome.
Okay.
So, this reminds me of this 2006 movie called Grandma's Boy.
Is there a waterbed with lasers?
No, but the guy gets fired from his job and he goes and stays at his coworker's house. And when he gets into his bedroom, the guy's got a fucking car bed.
Yeah.
So it's a bed that has the car frame.
Yeah, that's what this had, except it's a waterbed.
And the guy's like, you got a car bed? He's like, yeah, but it's a fucking sweet car bed.
I'll play you the scene after this.
All right. I got to see this, because where did the lasers come from?
That's the thing. Like, the lasers don't make any fucking sense. Like, when they push the horn and the laser thing happens, it makes no sense. Like, where, like, there's no, like, lasers in the room. It's just, like, the disco ball starts going, yep. And I think smoke starts coming out, and then there's close-ups of, like, laser shooting. And then I guess they have really good sex.
This is too goddamn elaborate for me.
Anyway, it was a great bed, and it made me want to have a waterbed.
Well, I can see it now, but trust me, they're shit.
Just quit pissing on the fantasy, okay?
If they shot lasers, it might be different.
Just this one shot lasers, so just shut your mouth. Just go with it. Okay.
Okay.
We also had roller skaters on... I can't top the waterbed now. We also had roller skaters along Venice Beach. There was a big naked photo shoot where the, like, tubby guy was, like, trying to, like, get some action.
Of course.
We had the announcer lady from Death Race 2000 showed up as one of their husbands. 45 Graves Party Time plays a few times. Now, here's the thing. Oh, just a couple of other actors that were in it. Darcy DeMoss shows up. She was in Friday 6. Kane Hodder shows up as, like, kind of a, like, this, like, like, nerdy jock beach patrol. Christy Summers and Kathleen Kinmont from Halloween 4 also shows up as the roller skating chick. Now, the most interesting part is there was a band in this movie. Do you know this? I don't think you do know this.
I haven't seen Hard Bodies in a long time.
So there's a band, a girl band in this movie called Diaper Rash.
Okay.
And I'm, like, watching it, and they're in it over and over again. They have this song.
The Go-Go's?
They have this song called, no, it's not the Go-Go's. They have this song called Computer Madness. And then when it came on, I, like, totally remembered the song and stuff, and it was super 80s. And anyway, I'm like, I totally fucking recognize that guitar player. So I looked it up, and it's fucking Vixen.
What?
Remember Vixen?
Yeah.
It was Vixen.
I've been standing on the edge of your broken heart.
It was Vixen. It was the singer of Vixen and the guitar player before they were Vixen.
You know what? I think I might have been watching Behind the Music with Vixen, and they mentioned that.
I'm sure they did. I couldn't believe it. Because I totally recognize it. I'm like, I recognize that guitar player. And sure enough, that's who it was. And I even watched, like, a video of this and then like Edge of the Broken Heart. And, like, the singer, I can't place her as the same person. The guitar player for sure, though.
It's pretty sad you mentioned that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I think they might have mentioned that on the Behind the Music.
I still have my self-titled Vixen album.
Because I spend a lot of time on YouTube watching Behind the Music and fucking Bands Reunited lately. And I don't know why.
Because it's awesome?
I guess so.
I love watching those. And obviously you do too.
I guess so, but it's kind of embarrassing.
Why?
I don't know.
You love the 80s.
Well, Vixen were, like, were they 80s? I guess late 80s.
Late 80s.
You still have the self-titled?
Yeah, I do.
Does that have Edge of a Broken
Heart? I've seen Vixen live.
With who?
I think they opened for George Thorogood.
That's a weird comp.
I'm pretty sure that's who they opened for. They opened for someone, and I'm pretty sure it was George Thorogood. It is a weird combo.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right. Man, this fucking Hard Bodies has a lot of tangents right now.
Well, anyway, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Very sexist, but a lot of fun. A lot of nudity, a lot of summer. made me want to go to the beach, even though I hate the beach. But the beach is not like this movie, so I won't be going to the beach. But anyway.
I have this on Blu-ray.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have like that 4-pack that Mill Creek put out.
Yeah, so do I. That's what I watched.
This and like, what, Spring Break and...
Perfect.
Perfect and Private Resort, right?
Private Resort, yeah.
You should watch Private Resort next.
I know.
That one's fun.
I know. I'm going to watch
Johnny
all of
Depp's
them.
In that shit.
Johnny Depp and Rob Morrow.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. And Perfect. I haven't seen that in forever.
I've never seen Perfect.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we'll
Jamie
see.
Jamie Lee in a leotard?
Yeah.
Might be good.
Might be good. I've seen it.
What about Hard Bodies 2?
Hard Bodies 2 is really hard to get.
Hmm. Yeah. I remember Hard Bodies 2 not being as good.
No?
It wasn't the same. It was like they took out the beach theme and made it into like actors on this movie set and kind of made it like match up with Greek mythology and stuff.
Yeah, I think one of the old guys is back, Sorrel Packard. But I don't think Grant Kramer's back, and I think he's kind of what made this movie. He was really the glue of this movie, and he was very likable, and I thought he kind of made this movie what it made it kind of endearing somewhere.
All I can say to you, Josh, is that with a mention of laser waterbeds and a mention of diaper rash, I will be talking about this movie next episode.
Are you going to watch it?
I'm going to watch it.
Yeah, it's pretty great, man.
I'm gonna watch it.
Pretty great.
I'm gonna.
You're like committing?
I'm committing to watching.
You're committing on air, dude.
I know. I'm committing to watching Hard Bodies by next show.
And I shouldn't be so hard on the beach in the summer. I'm really trying, but I've never had a really good experience at the beach. It's kind of my thing with the beach. I don't mind being like on a private beach, or if you want to go for a walk. Well, not you, but if someone wanted to go for a walk on the beach.
You want to go for a walk with me on the beach?
Well, not really.
What the fuck?
Well, okay, we can go for a walk on the beach.
All right, sweet.
But you know that...
Wreck beach?
No, hell no. I don't want anyone to see that. I also don't want to take my shirt off at a beach because I don't want to like reflect the sun back and blind everyone.
No, dude, you're pasty.
I really am. But I think if I was at a beach like in Hard Bodies, as much as I think it would be cool, I think I'd be really annoyed. And I was on a crowded beach last summer, and I really didn't enjoy myself. I was just like, fuck off, everyone. Get that dog away from me.
I feel like if I was on a beach like Hard Bodies, it would be awkward. Because I'd be like that pasty movie nerd in the middle of all these hot people. I'd be like, what the fuck am I doing here? I want to be in my hotel room watching Malibu Bikini Shop or something. This is different. This is too difficult for me. Look at all these hot chicks. I got a boner. What am I going to do?
I know. I think busy beach is like best served as movie fantasy for me. But like the beach in general, as long as it's not crowded, I'm fine. But if the fucking sun's beating down too, it just puts me in a bad mood. Anyway.
That's Hard Bodies, folks. Holy fuck. Anyhow, my last selection is a TV movie.
Oh.
From the 70s.
Ooh.
That I've never seen.
Ah.
Because Josh and I have a strange love for 70s TV movies, don't we?
Who doesn't?
Like, there was that we've talked about this in the past. Like, in the 70s, especially, and somewhat in the 80s, they always had these things called Movie of the Week. And they were, like, just movies that came out once a week. You'd get it Friday nights or whatever, and they'd be, like, themed to whatever was popular in the theaters at the time or what was, you know, and things like that. So you'd get all these weird movies like Killdozer, and you would get, like...
Bad Ronald
and all this stuff. And it was a pretty creative time for television, if you ask me.
Yeah, it was great.
And so I decided I had found a double feature DVD of a couple of 70s TV movies. And I was like, I was so excited that this one was on there because this is one's considered to be one of the cream of the crop 70s TV movies. So I watched Satan's School for Girls.
Oh, nice. Have you ever seen it?
Never seen it.
Oh, okay.
So this is from 1973. Co-produced by Aaron Spelling,
yeah,
who would go on to do Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place and all that.
But Charlie's also Angels.
Did Charlie's Angels. Yeah. Also did Love Boat, I believe, right?
I don't know about that. But
I think he might have done Love Boat too, yeah. But he's basically a very chintzy, kind of goofy TV producer.
Yeah.
Dad of Tori Spelling. Sorry. So this is a movie where in the 70s there was satanic panic.
Yeah.
There was the, you know, everyone was afraid their kids were going to fall into witchcraft and Satanism and all that kind of stuff. So this was a movie that kind of played into that.
Yeah.
This movie starts off so rad, dude. Like, it's a scene of a girl, like, desperately driving away, and she's just, like, so, like, oh, my God, oh, my God, and you don't know why she's driving away, and she's looking all, like, scared and looking around, and she ends up, like, stopping at a gas station to call somebody, and she sees this guy emerge from the gas station. She freaks out and drives home. So she's, like, at home, and, you know, next thing you see is her turning around, and it's, like, POV shot, and she starts screaming, just, like, repeatedly screaming into the camera. I'm, like, this is rad. I'm like, I'm automatically in.
Yeah.
Into the picture comes a, what's her name now? Pamela Franklin, playing the sister of that girl.
Yep.
And she shows up at the house because, and, you know, they open the door and there's her sister hanging from the rafters.
Nice.
So she's dead. She's hanging. And they're like, oh, she committed suicide. Pamela Franklin's character goes, there's no way my sister would commit suicide. Something's up.
Yeah.
I'm going to get a false identity. I'm going to go to the university she was attending, the private school she was attending, called the, what's it called, Josh? The Salem Academy. And I'm going to go there and I'm going to investigate the death. She shows up at the Salem Academy and sure as shit, a bunch of the students at the school also start showing up dead. Also, apparently, suicides.
Wow.
So the film kind of goes into this Nancy Drew-ish kind of vibe where her and her co-students, played by Kate Jackson and Cheryl Ladd, both from Charlie's Angels
and, yeah.
After this, and they like look into it. The teachers are acting weird. They're creeping around the school. There's a lot of scenes of them creeping around at night in the school holding lanterns and flashlights and all that stuff. So that's where I got this Nancy Drew kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's a pretty rad scene of them going into this room and all the, it's like the science teacher's classroom and all of his lab animals have been killed by him. And he pops out and he's like, they're not going to get me. They're not going to get me. And he jumps out the window from the second story and runs off. And I'm like, that's pretty sweet. And it's just like, it's just one of those like totally 70s movies where it's like, oh no, there's something mean, there's something going on. This is like Nancy Drew meets Scooby-Doo. And then at the end, when you find out it's satanic rituals and all this shit, you're like, I saw this coming, but it's still pretty awesome.
Nice.
So it's got a couple of slow parts here and there, admittedly, because it is doing that Nancy Drew vibe, and it is a television movie, so, you know, there's obvious cuts to commercials, there's obvious, like, we can't go too far with this because it's a TV movie, but there's just some odd charm to this movie.
Yeah.
Like, I'm watching going, you know, I'm not really thinking this is, like, the best movie in the world, but I'm pretty entertained, and I'm still kind of into it. It helps that Franklin is really good in this. Like, there's just something about her. She made her film debut in 1961's The Innocents,
right,
which is considered to be one of like the greatest ghost movies of the 60s. I've never seen it, but I've heard it's supposed to be really good.
Yeah.
She only acted till like 1981 before she retired, so she wasn't in a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But in this movie, she's got like that cute Audrey Hepburn pixie haircut. And she's like kind of got, you can still hear slight tinges of her British accent. And she's just going around being like as Nancy Drew as she can. And I'm like, she's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've got Jackson's character is like one of the kind of rebellious girls. And, you know, she's kind of role you'd see Margot Kidder playing in like Black Christmas the next year and stuff like that without the alcoholism.
Right.
But, you know, it's just like fun characters. And it just fascinates me, the satanic panic shit that went on in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Where everyone thought their kids were going to be like into cults and stuff.
They did, yeah.
And I'm just like, why? Why was this a thing?
It was really hyped up, yeah.
It was like there's that that book, Satanic Panic, by, what's their name?
Kayla Janice.
Yeah, Spectacular Oracle. Ocular, is that the company?
Spectacular Optical, yeah. She edited it.
And, yeah, so there's that.
It's a
book.
Nice book, yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty good book, but it's just like weird how this was a thing.
Yeah.
And you know, it's got the gothic kind of feel to it where Franklin's character's walking around with a lantern through the dark hallways and all that stuff. And you know, I can't say it was like a movie that I was like totally like in suspense for or totally like, oh, this is so entertaining. But there was just something about it that when it was over, I was like, you know, that was kind of fun.
Nice.
It was just one of those 70s TV movies where you're watching, like, that was all right. I think I kind of like that.
Cool.
And this is considered to be one of the big 70s horror TV movies. Like, yeah. This is the one everyone talks about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure there's... I prefer Trilogy of Terror and things like that over this for 70s TV movies, but I had a fun time with this. Directed by David Lowe Rich, who made a lot of TV stuff, but he also made, Josh, Concord Airport 79.
Oh, the only one I haven't seen.
Fully acknowledged as probably the worst of the airport movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I've got the airport franchise pack at home. So eventually David Lowe Rich is going to come back into my life. But it's a pretty good little flick. Remade in 2000.
Yeah.
By Spelling Producing again with Shannon Doherty, who at the time was starring in the show Charmed that he was also responsible for. So
nice.
If you're into this kind of stuff, or if you just dig 70s TV movies like we do, you should definitely check this one out. It's so easy to get because it's like pretty much public domain. So there's so many DVD releases of this.
Nice.
And this was actually paired, the DVD I got was paired with another 70s occult movie starring Kim Cattrall.
Really?
Of all people. And I don't remember what it's called, but I'm watching that pretty soon too.
Nice.
But the print on my copy, dude, still washed out and grungy.
Yeah, I know.
That's the thing about public domain.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I've only seen Satan's School for Lust with Misty Mondave.
Well, don't worry, dude. You'll get your chance.
Nice.
So that's Satan's School for Girls.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right.
Josh's VHS Adventures!
Okay. So I was a little bad this week and... I actually bought some VHS. I know. It's like a freaking addiction.
The whole purpose of this was so you could get rid of VHS.
I know. So, like, I think I bought enough that, like, everything I've reviewed on this segment, I've replaced. No, it's not that bad. I only bought, like, 8. But this is one that I just kind of threw in the basket on a bit of a whim, not really paying much attention to it, and just sort of was like, whatever. It looks okay. And I just forgot to mention that one of the co-stars of Hard Bodies, actually there's two people I want to mention. Roberta Collins shows up in it, one of my favorite 70s actresses. But also Courtney Gaines shows up in it, good old Malachi from
Malachi.
Children of the Corn. And, you know, I really only know Gaines as a bad guy.
I'm pretty sure he's in Joysticks, too.
I don't know if he's in Joysticks, but he's been in some sex comedies for sure. But he was the complete opposite of Malachi in Hard Bodies. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing all this up is because this movie that I watched for VHS also stars Courtney Gaines. And in this movie, he's back to his bad boy roots, his Malachi roots, where he's playing a bad guy. But he is a hell of a bad guy in this movie. And this is a movie called The Killing Grounds from 1997, directed by Kurt Anderson. So this... this movie is about, it's a survival movie, kind of a bit like, what's that Sam Raimi movie that you like so much about them finding the money?
A Simple Plan?
It's kind of like a bit like A Simple Plan in the premise, in that there's a heist that goes on in Beverly Hills where these guys steal all these diamonds, and then they take the diamonds up in a small plane. Courtney Gaines is involved with this as one of the bad guys. The diamonds go up in a small plane that flies over the wilderness, but then there's some sort of event that happens where the plane ends up crashing and the pilots die and this plane's just stuck in the middle of the wilderness. Meanwhile, we've got some campers, of course, camping, going on a hike in the area with their Native American guide. And they're just sort of going around. They're trying to find a good camping spot. So the movie kind of cuts back and forth between the campers and Courtney Gaines, like, trying to figure out where the plane went down and how to get the... you're wrong, right? He's not in Joysticks, is he?
He's not in Joysticks.
Yeah. Okay. So the Courtney's trying to like find out where the diamonds are with his partner, Anthony Michael Hall. And you're thinking, Anthony Michael Hall is a bad guy? Yeah. These two are great together and they do some there's one of the first scenes we see with this pair, because they're like going down, shaking down all these people, trying to figure out where the plane went down. But in the first scene, it's got them together, and they work really well together. But the scene ends with Courtney Gaines ripping off a guy's prosthetic arm and then beating him to death with it.
I'm in.
Then the next sort of vignette we have with Courtney and Anthony Michael is them finding this little person, like a short, not a true little person, but a really short guy, and they're in a dry cleaner, and they're kind of torturing him, like trying to figure out where the diamonds are. And guess who this guy is?
Don't know.
John Franklin.
John Franklin, friggin' Isaac?
Isaac from Children of the Corn. Really? So it was awesome because it was like Malachi torturing Isaac. So if you're a Children of the Corn fan, you'll totally get it.
I had to think about it for a minute, but then I got it.
Okay, so this is all happening, and I'm like, oh my God, this is like way beyond what I thought this movie was going to be. And like I said, Courtney and Anthony are a really great team. And I'm not a big Anthony Michael Hall fan, but I thought he was great in this as well. The campers now, who were also with for part of the movie, it's a husband and wife played by Priscilla Barnes from Three's Company, who's great, and Charles Rocket, who is also great. And Chris has told the story about Charles Rocket when he was talking about It's Pat. Great actor, got himself fired from Saturday Night Live and ended up meeting a particularly tragic end by suicide, by slitting his own throat in a field. But he was really quite good in this at being a real asshole. And I haven't seen It's Pat. I've seen him in other things, and I've seen him on Saturday Night Live, of course. But it was interesting seeing him in this because I didn't really realize it was him because it was, you know, quite a few years past his kind of prime. But he was like kind of a big, beefy jock type and just a total dick. Like, he was Priscilla Barnes' wife, but he was like just this loser guy. Like, he never really worked and was always like you know, coming up with these bad schemes, made them lose all their money. He's cheating on her all the time. Just, you know, and every time a girl, like, another character shows up at one point, and he's just like macking on her right in front of his wife. Like, just a total prick, right? And I was like, wow, this guy is a fucking asshole. But then I was like, well, you know, it takes a lot to really make you hate someone on screen. Yeah, you were just rooting for this guy to die from like the minute you saw him. So he was really great in that role. The Native American guy is played by Rodney A. Grant from Dances with Wolves and Geronimo. And he's like their wise guide that's taking them through the forest. Eventually they get to the plane, and then it becomes the whole thing, like, do we take the diamonds, do we leave them, da 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 da, da. And then eventually they run into Anthony Michael and Courtney, and the shit hits the fan. So just a great, like, outdoors sort of like hiking movie. Then it becomes like a what's the right thing to do movie, and then it becomes kind of, you know, an escape movie where they're trying to get away from Courtney and Anthony and Michael. It takes some really great turns. There was a lot of surprises. I thought it was shot really well. There's a Philip Michael Thomas reference. It was really funny seeing Courtney and Anthony Michael on horses because they're totally awkward. Gaines' character is like the type of guy who like can't get his horse to go, so he jumps off it and shoots the horse dead. Just pretty funny stuff. Really, really, really liked this one. So a total fluke. I never would have expected to, and it was kind of one I just threw in at the last minute and the one I watched first because I thought it was going to be the first one I was going to get rid of. So really liked it, and was available on DVD for a time, I think, in like a full frame transfer. But I would definitely recommend The Killing Grounds, even though it's got a terrible title.
It's one of those movies where you pick it up and you think, I'm gonna watch the shittiest thing first. And you're surprised.
When John Franklin showed up, and
that is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. So all right, there you go.
Josh's VHS Adventures.
All right. So now that we've forced our way through all those movies and probably are at an hour and a half or longer.
You're pretty close.
Yeah. Let's get into our topic. So the reason I really I find this quite interesting. It's just because, you know, aside from a handful of people that, you know, are maybe or that might be a bit arguable these days, you know, the 70s and 80s, particularly the 70s, were filled with, like, tough guys. Like, you know, the real kind of, like, man's man. Yeah, just, like, kind of that image of macho. And, you know, when you watched an action movie from that time period, it had these guys in it. You always kind of... It's just this real kind of image of masculinity. And I've just found that that's really kind of changed. And I think a lot of it for me, a big change was in the 80s when it seemed to be that you had to start giving your tough lead actor guy quips and like comedy. And that I feel is what's kind of partially what's responsible for stripping away this kind of tough guyness. And I just can't take like Matt Damon as seriously as I could Clint Eastwood as Dirty Harry. You know, I just Jason Bourne just doesn't quite cut it for me the same way that Charles Bronson did, you know. And I really kind of miss those old days, and I think that's why I keep going back to those. But I just find it's something that's really, really changed in cinema, aside from a few people who I will mention. But yeah, I mean, thoughts, Chris?
Well, it's like nowadays, we were saying this when we were talking about this topic. We were like, nowadays it's not about your actors particularly. Yeah. It's more about how much effects you can throw on a screen, how you can get audiences. It's not about the actors. Like, for a lot of the guys we're going to talk about now, their names would be on the credits and you'd be like, I know instantly what I'm getting. I know exactly what kind of movie this is going to be. I'm going to go see it. Like, a lot of these guys, it might be called typecasting these days, but the thing is, these are guys who did this kind of stuff and did it well. And this was, especially in the 70s, these were decades where this is what an audience wanted, though. Like, they wanted to have these heroes who were just, like, tougher than tough, who could, like, overcome anything and just, you know, plow through whatever was put in front of them and do the right thing and you know, and look good doing it. That's the thing. Whereas these days, it's like nobody cares who the fucking hero of these movies is particularly. They're just like, oh yeah, we're going to get to this cool finale where there's going to be like a 20-minute fight between these characters we don't give a shit about.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the main thing I got from compiling this list, because I think the actual death of tough guys came probably in the early 90s. In the sense that...
At the latest, yeah.
Yeah, like in the sense that you'd have these movies coming out from guys like Seagal and guys like that, where they could be played in theaters and they were still kind of making money. But then it feels like society shifted a little bit. Like, it became a little bit more politically correct. It became a little bit more, oh, we can't really do that kind of stuff because, mm-hmm. you know, this violence is frowned upon. Or, you know, maybe it's a little bit sexist to have these men in these roles because, it, you know, they're just too macho or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it all started just becoming a direct-to-DVD, direct-to-video kind of thing. So, you know, there's still sort of that direct-to-video outlet for certain things, like a guy like Scott Adkins and guys like that, but you don't see this anymore, and it is a lost thing. And you know, there's a difference between when you go to put on a movie that's a big studio movie these days, and you're like, what your expectations are, whereas you go and put on like an Eastwood movie from the 70s or something like that, your expectations are entirely different. And I find that I actually enjoy that 70s movie a lot more than I do what's going on now, because you had a well-defined hero who you knew what you were getting from them, and you knew that no matter what happened, they would just kick ass their way right through it. Like, these were guys who were like role models, really, if you think about it.
True. I mean a lot of the ones on my list I don't know if are necessarily are gonna get the way through everything. Like, I mean
you have to have a little bit of vulnerability to your characters too, admittedly, but a lot of these guys, they showed up in these tough movies, right?
Yeah.
So you had that attitude, and then when something did happen to them, you were like kind of shocked.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the vulnerability was something that you were like, we can't have that at all.
Yeah.
But most of the time, these were guys who would just like solve problems, get shit done.
Yeah.
Any way possible.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, and I also find, like, just the way, you know, there's been a big change in cinema and the way people look as well. And I feel like there just seems to be a much more emphasis on looks in the last 20 years than there was in the 70s. Like, Charles Bronson was not the most good-looking man I've ever seen. But, you know, he could star in movies. I don't think you could have someone like that starring in movies these days.
No.
I don't think it would fly. So I think that's a big thing as well. And you know, it's almost like, I hate to say pretty boys, but, like, I find, like, you know, when Tom Cruise and Matt Damon are your biggest action stars, for the most part, it is kind of like, it doesn't really, yeah, it seems odd to me. Like, I just, like, you know, I mean, a good example is, like, when I was reading, I read the first Jack Reacher novel. And the picture I had in my head of that guy was nothing like Tom Cruise. And so, yeah, I just found that, you know, just to be some odd choices that way. And even Mission Impossible, I just, you know, don't really picture Ethan Hunt the way he is, the way Tom Cruise portrays him.
But do you feel like maybe the Jack Reacher thing was because Bourne was so successful and they wanted to kind of get an actor who was sort of Matt Damon-ish? Stature wise and stuff like that, like kind of the same body type,
I guess. So but I mean of... I was picturing, like, you know, Bo Svenson or something. Yeah, right? Yeah, like, yeah, like, or Chuck Connors. Like, that's kind of what I had in my head, not Tom Cruise.
But it's like, even these days, the guys who you would expect to be these, like, kind of macho kind of action stars, like guys like, you know, The Rock, like Dwayne Johnson and that, even they're doing stuff that you're kind of like, you wouldn't see Bronson doing this kind of movie back in the day, you know? You wouldn't see Journey to the Center of the Earth 2 or The Tooth Fairy or things like that. Like, there's not really... The only guy now who I can think is kind of doing what the kind of stuff we're talking about, like the macho thing now, is like Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
He seems to be the only guy who's doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've got a couple of other examples that he's definitely on my list.
Yeah.
But it just seems like, and I think the other big difference is the guys back in the day were doing shit that you actually could physically happen.
Yeah.
Like, when you're watching a movie with The Rock, I love The Rock, I've made no secret about it, but he's not, like, it's totally unrealistic. Like, that shit isn't going to happen in real life. Whereas if you watch Dirty Harry, it's totally realistic. Like, that could actually happen. Even RoboCop, right? Like, not that RoboCop theoretically could happen, but what he's doing is possible.
Well, and the thing is, too, is that a lot of these guys, what they were doing, like the kinds of films they were doing, were rooted in, you know, reality. Like when I was doing my slight notes for this, I noticed trends, you know? Like, a lot of these guys, they mostly did, like, westerns, or they did, like, war movies and stuff. So these are things that were rooted in reality, rooted a little bit in history.
Yeah.
And things like that. You know, you're not going to see a guy like, you know, John Wayne going and fighting fucking aliens in space and stuff, you know? So I feel like that, like, you know, having a guy going and fighting aliens or doing whatever, like giant monsters like The Rock does in Rampage and stuff, that is going to cheapen your kind of image of them being macho, because you have the history of World War II and you have the history of the Old West and, you know, all that stuff that you already know in your head about that stuff. And that is elevating these actors who are doing these roles to being like, oh yeah, these guys are pretty badass because they're living through this fantasy world of what really happened. So you have a really good point on that.
And even if the stuff was a bit unrealistic at the time, like slightly unrealistic, you could still kind of buy it. Like, I've got a good example I've thought of, and, you know, I mean, I'm going to go back to one of my faves, The Black Hole. But there's a scene in The Black Hole, because Robert Forster is one of the guys I'm going to be talking about tonight. Right. There's a scene in The Black Hole where they're in the spaceship and there's this giant fucking meteor. Like, okay, totally unrealistic that would happen, but there's a giant meteor rolling towards them, a la Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah. And they're like on this bridge and they're like, oh my God, there's a giant meteor. And they just run off the bridge. if this was a Rock movie, like, he would be, like, fucking parkouring up the sides, and a helicopter would be coming, and he'd jump up, and he'd, like, swing up off the, on a rope ladder, and just miss it, and, like, his ass would get burned or some shit.
Yeah.
Like, that's what would happen in a Rock movie, whereas in the Black Hole, like, they just run off the bridge. So, like, you know, at least you can kind of buy it, whereas in, like, the modern action movies, it's so ridiculous. Like, I saw the new Mission Impossible trailer, like, the shit that's going on in that trailer, like, I'm just like, he'd be dead, like, you can't even fathom it.
There's just no real risk in these new movies.
Yeah.
Like, if you think about it, because when you're watching them, exactly what you're saying, like, when you're watching the trailer, you're like, this is so ridiculous that there's no risk to me personally. Like, I don't feel like these characters are gonna, you know, well,
kind of like Pratt in Jurassic World. Well,
exactly. Like, at least in a lot of these movies and these guys we're talking about, there was that actual risk there where you're like, okay, I could see this really affect, like, you know, hurting this person, you know, because of the settings of the Old West and the war and all that stuff. Like, but if you've got them, like, even the Black Hole to an extent, you're right. They would have made it a lot more ridiculous.
Oh yeah.
Nowadays.
Oh yeah.
Than it did in the '70s, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, we've talked about the Black Hole. We have a whole episode about the Black Hole, right?
Damn
so,
right, we do.
So if you want to know about the Black Hole, listen to that. But it's just the risk of modern movies is not there for me anymore because it's all about effects.
Yeah.
And it's all about. It's not really about character so much. Whereas, because even these guys that we're talking about, they'd be in different movies, but they'd always have the same kind of character to them.
Yeah.
There'd always be something about them that you're like, that is why they're like a tough guy or macho or whatever. That is the thing they have. That's the swagger they have.
The swagger. That's a perfect word
for it. A lot of these guys nowadays do not have.
Yeah. Yeah. Matt Damon doesn't have swagger.
No.
I hate to keep picking on him, but, I just, yeah.
Well, it's like I said, Neeson and what? Who? Maybe Jason Statham?
I wrote down Neeson. I wrote down Jason Statham. I wrote down Frank Grillo.
Yeah.
And I wrote down Vince Vaughn, but you would not know that. But if you see Brawl in Cell Block 99, you would understand why I put that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how?
But those are really the only ones I could think of off the top of my head of modern day equivalents.
So how should we do this? Do you want to just shoot names at each other or whatever? Okay, so who are you going to shoot out first here?
Well, the first one I wrote down was Lee Marvin.
Okay. I also have him written down.
Yeah, I mean, a great example. I mean, the guy had white hair and, was just a tough-looking son of a bitch. Wasn't really a ladies' man ever. No. He had his moments at some points, but kind of as a rule wasn't really a ladies man, but always kind of kicked ass. And like, you know, I mean, I'm talking, you know, the first thing I saw Lee Marvin, and I think it was probably The Dirty Dozen. I think was probably the first one, followed by Hell in the Pacific, which is a totally wild movie if you've never seen it. Actually not wild, but just a very unique film. But both of them, he's playing like a soldier, and he's he's like the leader of the squadron in Dirty Dozen, and just one of those like kick-ass army captain dudes, and that, like Chris said earlier, just, you know, he's gonna get shit done. Of course, we know Lee Marvin as well from both of one of our most favorite recent discoveries, a movie called Prime Cut from the 70s, which was Lee Marvin was totally awesome in that movie as well. And he's just been great in everything that I've seen him show up in. He was also in, name some other one, like, well, Point like Blank.
The first movie I actually saw him in was Delta Force.
Delta Force, of course, yeah.
Like, which is his last movie. Yeah. So when I had saw Delta Force in like the late 80s, I came out in 86, I was totally into Chuck Norris, right? Yeah. And I was like, who's this old dude that he's got as a sidekick? And I'm watching him like, but the thing is, that old dude's kicking more ass than Chuck is in a way, right? So that's what I was kind of like, oh, I got to find out who this guy is. Because he, you know, you're like, he had the white shock white hair, and he just had that grizzled kind of like
look on his face. Like, he had that I don't take no shit look on his face.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, who's this guy? And that's when I saw The Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
That's when I saw, you know, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance with James Stewart.
Yeah.
And it's Point Blank, obviously.
Yeah.
Like, Point Blank's probably his most famous.
Yeah.
After Dirty Dozen, I'd say Point Blank's the movie that Point Blank's the movie that you would point at and say, that's what epitomizes Lee Marvin to me.
Yeah.
Because he plays like an assassin guy and he's just like badass. He's wearing the suit and he just looks fucking slick.
Yeah.
And like we said, Prime Cut, which we both discovered in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So fucking rad in Prime Cut.
Thank you, Kino Lorber.
Yeah. Like, he's so rad in Prime Cut. And he's just like, he's just in Prime Cut. He's just like, you can tell, like, with the Sissy Spacek character, he's like, I'm going to protect you, but I'm going to kick as much fucking ass as I need to to do that. At the same time, I'm enough of a real man that I can go to the bar and pummel down a bourbon or a whiskey or something before I go out and kick some ass.
Yeah.
You know, he was just so cool.
Yeah, he was so cool.
In Prime Cut, right? And, you know, obviously, when you think of Dirty Dozen, though, this blew my mind because Dirty Dozen came up a lot when I was looking at the guys, right? Look at the people who are in Dirty Dozen, dude. You got Jim Brown.
Yeah.
You got Charles Bronson. You got Ernest Borgnine, you got George Kennedy, and more. Like, such a fucking good cast. Yeah,
it is.
And it's such a good movie.
Yeah.
And it's from the director, Robert Aldrich, who did, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, all the Marbles.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this guy makes good movies, and that's definitely Lee Marvin's high point.
Yeah.
But he's just such a cool guy.
Yeah, he is.
Like,
I think he was in the Big Red one as well, if I'm not mistaken, that Sam Fuller movie.
He might have been,
yeah.
I didn't write down everything for him.
Yeah.
So another guy like him, like, that has the same kind of, where you look at him and you're like, that guy could be my grandpa, but I wish my grandpa was that fucking cool, is Sam Elliott, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so older Sam Elliott, right? Like, this is a guy, when I saw him in, like, Shakedown in 88.
You in Shakedown,
everybody,
man,
knows my love of Shakedown, right? Like, everybody knows how much I love Shakedown. This guy's just so fucking cool.
Yeah.
And, like, it's hard to put a finger on it because he's so cool because he's, like, the mentor to Patrick Swayze in Roadhouse. He's in Tombstone with, like, Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer and all the boys. Western. He's in all these Westerns when he's earlier. But the thing about him that makes it interesting is that he was super tough. He was super cool. But he also got cast as a romantic lead in a lot of movies, too.
Because chicks loved him.
And ladies love Sam Elliott.
He married Catherine Ross, for God's sake.
Like, they fucking love him. Even now.
Yeah.
Being, like, in his, I think he's in his 70s now.
Yeah.
And women are like, fuck, Sam Elliott's hot.
Yeah.
And if that's not a sign of you being a macho fucking dude, that you're, like, 70 years old and women who are, like, half your age are like, holy shit, Sam Elliott's so hot.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a, when I was doing my notes, there is a, have you ever seen Lifeguard?
Dude, I've talked about Lifeguard so many times.
I really want to see Lifeguard.
Yeah, though. I got it. I finally got it.
Did you finally get it?
Derry got me a copy.
You'll have to let me borrow that eventually. Yeah, man. Okay. What do you have about Sam Elliott? Anything?
No, I just think he's a dude. Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, yeah, like I said, he married Catherine Ross, which, who I thought was like a mega babe in the 70s. And he's just got that voice and just that confidence about him.
Well, yeah, it's a gravelly voice and just the, you're right. He's just like that kind of guy who's like, I'll just do whatever I want.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And that's the thing. A lot of these guys are just guys who you feel like they will do whatever they want and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. But one thing that you mentioned with when you're talking about him is Roadhouse.
Yeah.
And that is a movie that I actually kind of feel was a bit of a turning point in the whole tough guy thing. I think Swayze kind of changed things a little bit. Now, I'm not saying I hated Swayze, but I did find that him becoming an action star might have been part of what changed. And I don't know if I don't have anything to really base that on, but I was just thinking of the timing of Roadhouse and Point Break and that things did start to change. And
he was kind of pretty boyish.
Well, he was in Dirty Dancing and Ghost, and it was just kind of like, Sam Elliott would not have been in fucking Ghost, okay? You know, like, Lee Marvin would not have been in Dirty Dancing, even as a father. Like, you know, it just...
Yeah, like, I do like Roadhouse, and I do like Point Break.
Yeah.
But I never really did look at Swayze as an action star. You're right.
But he kind of was.
But he didn't have really the kind of gruff uniqueness that a lot of these guys had. And also, I meant to mention right off the top that another kind of prerequisite for this list is fucking mustaches. just so everyone
Lee
knows.
Lee Marvin didn't have a mustache.
No, but it is kind of a prerequisite for a lot of these guys, I noticed. Like, probably 75% of these guys, mustaches are kind of like the thing. At one time or another in their career.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
You don't feel that way?
I'm just taking a peek here, and I don't know. Well, okay.
I think mustaches are pretty important when you're a tough guy, Josh.
I don't know, man. I don't know. We'll have to look back on that.
All right, we'll keep a mustache tally as we go. So Sam Elliott's number one on the mustache tally.
Okay, well, now I'm going to feel like I'm going to be picking non-mustache people on purpose. Okay. I've already mentioned that. I'm going to talk about Robert Forster.
Yep.
Just because he was another dude that I just, he wasn't really like a tough guy, like a Lee Marvin, but he was like just kind of a dude. Like, he felt like a, like, he wasn't a pretty boy at all. He was just a guy, like, just a kind of regular guy that, like, got shit done, though. Like, I always felt like when Forrester was on screen, I always felt pretty safe. Now, he hasn't been in a ton of movies, but he was, he was obviously great in The Black Hole. He was great in Alligator. He was even great at, like, I thought he was a really, really great casting in Jackie Brown. And I just feel like he's one of these guys that just had that thing about him that wasn't really, he wasn't pretty. He was just a guy, and it just, and, but not an average guy. Like, you felt comfortable with him. He was in Medium Cool as well, another really neat movie. But you felt comfortable with him, but you felt like he was going to get job done, and he was going to, like, take care of things, but not in that kind of over the top way. And not in, he was kind of a more of a subtle tough guy, but he still had that. He still was a pretty cool dude. Do you have a lot of experience with Forster?
Forster's a guy who every time I see him, I like him.
Yeah.
But it's like, I didn't really write him down, so I don't have a lot of titles that pop to mind. But every time he shows up in something, I'm like, oh yeah, it's Forster. That's sweet, right? He's kind of like, you were saying, like, kind of saying how he's one of those guys who's like sort of a regular dude.
Yeah.
But you know he's going to get stuff done. And that's kind of like, I always compare him to like a guy like Robert Ginty.
Right.
You know, and that's like who I have written down too.
Yeah.
It's like a guy like Ginty where he seems to be someone who could be your neighbor.
Yeah.
But has that side to him where if he's pushed, he's going to push back.
Yeah.
Because you know how a lot of us, if, you know, we would kind of cower a little bit or do whatever. Him, Forster and Ginty are kind of like those guys who are like, you could go and have a beer on their porch with them and hang out, but if someone was to mess with them, they're going to come at them like hard.
Well, it's very interesting, Chris, that you mentioned Ginty and when we're talking about Forster, seeing as Forster was the star of Vigilante, which is exactly what you're saying.
Well, exactly.
You know, and Ginty was the star of The Exterminator,
right.
Which is, so if, and I was, sorry, a major miss on me not mentioning Vigilante right away. But yeah, I mean, Forster, exactly. Like, you just felt like if you fuck with this guy, it's probably not going to end well for you.
Well, it's like you could be friends with him, and he'd be a cool dude to you, but the minute you cross him, you're going to either get shot or, like Ginty, burned with a flamethrower.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
So, like, let's move on to Ginty then. So this is a guy, he hasn't been in a lot of stuff either particularly. Much like Forrester.
He was in Whitefire, dude.
Well, yeah. Whitefire. So obviously the Exterminator is the movie everybody remembers him for. The Glickenhaus awesome 1980 production.
Yes.
But it's funny, like, the thing about Ginty is he's the guy who, he's kind of like Forrester. He shows up and you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, you don't really, like, really pay attention to his career. But when you're watching something and he shows up, it's always like this, oh yeah, that's Ginty. It's fucking on now.
Yeah. Have you said Robert Ginty yet? Or have we just
said Robert Ginty? I did say it.
I feel like we've been like, Ginty,
man. But, He you know, he had Whitefire, which I've never seen, but I've always wanted to see.
Oh, yeah, you got
to
see that.
Go to YouTube and type in Whitefire Chainsaw, and you get everything you need from that movie. But also go to YouTube and type in Hawaiian Heat, because that's that failed TV show he was in 1984 that Josh and I were kind of obsessed with for like a night or two. But he had a run of low-budget action movies in the late 80s with like generic titles like Out on Bail, Three Kinds of Heat, The Bounty Hunter. He also directed a bunch of them. And you know, he was just like a solid kind of action hero.
Yeah.
And he was like a guy who looked like he was in his late 40s, early 50s, and was just, you know, exactly the thing. A guy who lived next door who would just get the stuff done.
Yeah.
So that's why I had him kind of written on mine.
Yeah. No, he's a good pick for sure. I'll go with an obvious one next. I think Steve McQueen is a really good pick.
I wrote him down also.
And just, I mean, he was just such a cool dude. The first thing I saw Steve McQueen in was a movie called Tom Horn, which is one of his like lesser known titles, Western. But I just thought he was so awesome in that. And then I think I followed that up with Bullet, which of course is a classic, but he was just like a really, really cool cop that just dressed cool and got cool girls and drove a cool car, and just everything about him was pretty fucking cool.
It's funny that with McQueen, though, I kind of didn't get to Bullet till I had seen, like, the first thing I remember seeing him in was Wanted Dead or Alive, his Western TV show. Yeah, yeah. Because I kind of grew up, when I was growing up, I used to watch, like, you know, kind of syndicated television on the weekends.
Right.
During the daytime. And I saw a lot of Wanted Dead or Alive when I was a kid. And at the time, I didn't really know who Steve McQueen was. I just knew he was this cool, like, Western bounty hunter type.
Yeah.
You know, and I find it weird that they made a movie in the 80s with Rutger Hauer called Wanted Dead or Alive that's very loosely based on the McQueen show. Even though it's set in modern times.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's really weird. Huh. But I remember that, and actually the second movie, the first thing I remember being aware of him was actually Cincinnati Kid.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which is not even really an action movie.
No.
It's just a Norman Jewison directed movie about him being like this, like, really, really awesome gambler.
Yeah.
Who, you know, everybody wanted to take down, but he had such cool... He just had a cool charisma and charm to him.
Yeah.
And it was like after Cincinnati Kid, I'm like, okay, I kind of like this Steve McQueen guy. And that's when I discovered Bullet, because I had been like, you know, kind of ingesting all these like top 100, you know, movies of all time books and stuff. And Bullet would always be on there for like the best car chase and everything. And you'd be like, okay, I'm watching Bullet finally. And then... obviously, the car chase is the highlight of Bullet.
Yeah.
But McQueen's character was just really like a cool, kind of like take no guff kind of cop, right?
Yeah.
So he was really cool in that. And then what else did I have written down? Obviously, I saw The Great Escape.
Yeah.
After that, I saw The Towering Inferno not long after that. And, you know, The Getaway, the Peckinpah movie, which...
Yep.
You know,
Ali McGraw
and him, great fucking team.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the movie with Baldwin and Basinger that they remade in 1994, not so good. And, you know, what else would you say? Magnificent Seven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was part of these ensemble movies, too, that has a lot of these guys in it. Like, that's the thing. A lot of these movies, too, with these tough guys were ensemble pieces.
Yeah.
So like The Dirty Dozen, like The Great Escape, like Magnificent Seven, these were where they would get a bunch of these fucking, like, the testosterone in the room when these movies were made must have been fucking outrageous. Like, I feel like within a 16 block radius, there was fucking like, you know, like women getting pregnant without even being touched because of the testosterone in the room. Like, this is like divine conception going on, because there's so many of these fucking like macho guys in one place.
And it was different than like the Expendables, because it just felt like a little more like, I've always felt
natural.
I always feel the Expendables feels a little forced to me.
Yeah. But, it feels a lot more natural. Like they were like, who can we get in this movie who are going to work together, who have the same characteristics?
Yeah.
As opposed to the Expendables, was like, who's kind of washed up?
Yeah.
Who had a heyday in action movies that we can get together, and that people who grew up in that era are going to be like, that's cool, I'm going to go see that.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know? And McQueen was even cool. Like, I mean, even like the Thomas Crown Affair, which is definitely not an action movie.
Yeah.
He still was so cool.
Well, because like, he was kind of like that con man.
Yeah. He always had this thing going on with him in pretty much everything I've seen him in, even in The Blob, you know, and he was just one of those guys, and he just died way too young. And
Way too young.
It's just too bad. So, yeah, Steve McQueen definitely came to mind. No mustache.
Yeah, I know. No mustache. I know. I just seem like mustache seemed to be a prevalent theme, okay?
I get it. I do understand. I think I've got about a 50-50 mustache to non-mustache ratio.
Should we go into mustache?
Sure, do a mustache.
Who do you got for mustache?
Bronson.
Well, obviously.
Bronson had a fucking mustache.
Fuck, I feel like the Bronson's mustache was its own fucking person. I feel like his mustache could have starred in movies and I'd be happy.
So Charles Bronson was one of the greats of the 70s.
He's the OG. And macho he had, dude.
And you know, one thing I've noticed about a lot of these guys too is they were all very chill. Like, they never lost their shit, really. Like, you never really saw these guys yelling much. They were always really, and again, like, we brought it up, but just cool. They were just Bronson. Like, he never like freaked out. You know, he just was always cool. As with I think everyone else we've talked about, these guys were just always so cool. But Bronson just always. He was like the coolest of the cool, like, well, him and Eastwood. But I just, Bronson just always felt like he totally had it together, and was a really menacing screen presence just by the way he looks. Like, he was like kind of like, he kind of had a bit of like the Danny Trejo look. Like, he just had that tough, weathered look to him.
Well, yeah, he had like a stone face. So like, even when he was shooting you.
Yeah.
He didn't show any emotion for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that was the thing. This is another guy started out in Westerns.
Yeah.
He was in The Magnificent Seven as well.
Yeah.
He was also in The Great Escape. Mm-hmm. By far my favorite character in The Great Escape, I gotta admit. Yeah. He was also in Once Upon a Time in the West, another ensemble spaghetti Western this time. You know, and then Dirty Dozen. He's in the Dirty Dozen as well. So you see there's a theme that runs through this, is that they were getting all these guys together. And like I said, lots of pregnancies. But I think for me, the thing that was for Bronson would have been Death Wish and the Cannon Years.
The Cannon Years, for sure.
Like, and I know a lot of people shit on the Cannon Years. But for me, when in the 80s, when the Cannon Years were going on, and my heroes at the time were like younger guys, to have this 60-year-old man show up and be much more badass than the guys who were in these action movies I was watching, like, fucking Schwarzenegger didn't hold a candle to Bronson.
I mean,
Schwarzenegger was cool and all in the 80s. Like, I love fucking Commando and everything, but Bronson was just that guy. You'd be like, this guy could be my grandpa, and he's fucking destroying everybody.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing about Bronson. Like, you have Death Wish, obviously one of the greatest vigilante movies ever made.
Yeah.
You've got the canon Death Wish sequels, which are so fucking over the top that how can you not like them?
Yeah.
You've got Murphy's Law. You've got Kinjite, the Forbidden Subject. You got 10 to Midnight.
Yeah.
You got Assassination.
Yeah.
Like, you got all these movies that you know in your heart of hearts, they're not very good movies.
Yeah.
But you know that because Charles is in them, like Charlie's in these movies, you're like, this is going to be watchable no matter what.
Exactly.
Just because he's so fucking cool.
Yeah.
Like, cool is the main catchphrase today. Cool, yeah, and macho.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. Bronson and his mustache kicked ass.
Yep.
Yeah. So, come on, I keep saying
that. Should I do another mustache?
Yeah, do another mustache.
Okay. Let's see who I got for mustaches here, Josh.
I can easily do another mustache.
How about some Lee Van Cleef up in this bitch? There's a mustache.
Lee Van Cleef is definitely vast. I don't know a lot about him. I've seen him in what I've seen him in, but I don't know a lot about him.
The thing is, this is a guy whose debut performance was in fucking High Noon. And oh, when right. I talked yeah. about High Noon,
yeah. Yeah.
I had said High Noon didn't really do it for me as much as it does some people, but Lee Van Cleef was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, he had barely any screen time. He didn't really talk much, but just him sitting on a rock, smoking a cigarette, looking badass was enough for me to be like, that is the Lee Van Cleef I know.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm familiar with him from all the spaghetti western stuff. You know, the Eastwood Man with No Name stuff. Obviously, we've got Sabata.
Mm-hmm.
The Sabata series, we've got Day of Anger, you know, all that kind of stuff. Stuff that Arrow's put out.
Yeah.
So that you can kind of revisit his stuff. But what else do we have from him? We have freaking Escape from New York.
We do, yeah.
Like, Escape from New York, to see him show up in that, I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because Lee Van Cleef, he was just, didn't he also have that show, The Master? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, like, with Timothy Van Patten and Shokasugi.
Which just came out on Blu-ray from Kino.
Yeah.
Sorry. So, I mean, he was a guy, again, and The Octagon with Chuck.
Yep. He was the Satanic Mechanic as well. Boy, have you seen The Satanic Mechanic?
No, what's The Satanic Mechanic?
It's this movie that I just remember the cover, and I just remember Lee Van Cleef, and I was like, that's kind of what I associated with, and that's pretty
badass.
Is it
actually called The Satanic Mechanic?
Yeah, it's called The Satanic Mechanic.
Okay, I need to look into this when we're done. But he was another one, like Bronson. He was a guy who could be your grandpa.
Yeah, he totally could be.
Like in, like, you know, Escape from New York and that, because he... He was the bald guy with the mustache.
Yeah.
But he still would, like...
But you knew not to fuck with him.
Exactly.
If I was going to rob a store and I saw someone like Lee Van Cleef standing there, there's no fucking way I would have...
You'd just turn around and walk out?
Yeah, I would have. Yeah, I would have just turned my head and walked out.
But, I mean, he was the guy. When I associate myself with spaghetti westerns, he's one of the three names that pops up to me automatically when it comes to those kind of films.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something. I mean, considering there's, like, literally hundreds upon hundreds of spaghetti westerns, for his name to be one of the top recognized ones for me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It looks like The Satanic Mechanic, just FYI, is AKA for a movie called... hold on, it's just taking a sec here to come up. Oh, shit, I can't read it. But it's an Italian movie, The Perfect Killer.
The Satanic Mechanic.
Have you heard of The Perfect Killer?
No.
A hitman is allowed out of prison on the condition he continues killing for an organization, but he also becomes the target of a treacherous woman.
What year is it?
It is 1977. Lee Van Cleef, John Ireland. Yeah. It looks like it's Italian. But I think the AKA for it is The Satanic Mechanic.
Okay.
So there you go.
I might need to watch this.
I just remember the video box. It was just like him standing there and just looking badass.
It was called Satanic Mechanic.
Yeah.
And why didn't you rent it?
Original title, The Satanic
Mechanic.
But
why didn't you rent it?
I have it on VHS.
Oh. Good boy.
Right?
All right.
Yeah, Van Cleef was awesome. Okay. Let's just get Clint Eastwood out of the way, because I mean, he's so obvious, but he's so awesome at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the first things I saw him in, I think the first movie I saw Eastwood in was Sudden Impact, the third Dirty Harry movie, and I thought he was so cool then. And then I think I followed that up with Every Which Way But Loose and Any Which Way You Can.
Not so awesome.
Which
there.
You've told me you're not so awesome now, but when I was like 10, they
were
fucking awesome.
Well, when you were
10,
you were probably like, this is the best thing ever. It's a monkey's funny.
And I thought Clint Eastwood was really cool. I've also talked about Thunderbolt and Lightfoot on one of our underrated, I think the underrated 70s episode. And that's like a really, really great, great movie. But it really shows, because he's kind of, even in that, he's like the older criminal and paired up with Jeff Bridges, but you know, Jeff Bridges is like bouncing all over the place, but Eastwood's the one who like keeps his cool and like knows how to get the job done. Of course, he was in the Man with No Name movies, and which are great, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, really, really early badassness. But then he went into the, you know, all his other Westerns, which are all really kick-ass.
Yeah,
like, everything from, like, Two Bulls for Sister Sarah to...
Pale Rider.
Pale Rider, The Unforgiven. Yeah. I mean, he's so great. And even up until recently, like, even in Gran Torino, the guy is still, like, a badass. And he's, like, kind of, like, I mean, maybe the ultimate badass. I don't know. Like... But I mean, I just, yeah, I just wish I agreed with his politics a little more, but, and I really wish he didn't do that weird chair thing. But other than that, I mean, on film, I think Eastwood is just like primo. Even in something like The Bridges of Madison County, he's still cool, you know?
I'm pretty sure my first Eastwood movie was Firefox.
Really?
Yeah.
Firefox.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Where he's flying like the stealth jet.
He's been in so many fucking movies, then, too.
And then, like, Heartbreak Ridge. You remember Heartbreak Ridge? Where he was, like, the fucking drill sergeant guy? Yeah. He was intense in that fucking movie, dude. Like, Heartbreak Ridge and... he also... The Gauntlet, which I've never seen, but I've always wanted to see. I just bought that on Blu-ray, so I should visit that soon because I've heard that's pretty good.
The one like that looks like it should be a Dirty Harry movie, but it's not a Dirty Harry movie.
It's like a chase movie, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and... what else did I write down here? Oh, I just wanted to also mention that out of these guys, this is the guy who actually went and directed a lot of really good movies, too.
Yeah.
You know, like Play Misty for me is a really good movie that he starred in. Obviously, The Unforgiven, which we talked about. But he also made, like, Million Dollar Baby and Mystic River and that. Like, he's also very accomplished as a director as well. Yeah. And the guy's had a career for, what, like 70 years now? 60, 70 years?
Yeah.
So... He's got to be doing something right if he's still hanging around all these years later. And he is really the pinnacle cool. Like, when you see him in, like, the Man with No Name trilogy just smoking the cigars, you're like, yep.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that Dirty Harry's one of the most quoted movies of all time.
Yeah.
It's because he's just a badass, and that's all there is to it.
I can't wait to dive into those again, actually.
The Dirty Harry series?
Yeah, I haven't seen them in so long.
I recently bought the Blu-ray box set.
Yeah.
So I should also dive in. Maybe we should do a Dirty Harry episode.
Oh, that'd be good. There's five of them, though.
Yeah. Oh, no. Might take us, like, as long as the Bond episode's taken us.
Oh. Well, speaking of Bond.
Yes.
I did want to throw in Sean Connery because, you know, Bond overall, I don't really think of as a badass. But I did think Connery era Bond had that whole swagger thing going on. And I also think that Connery did some other movies around the 60s and 70s that were pretty interesting as well. Movies like The Offense is one that comes to mind. He was really good in The Untouchables, which even though that was in the 80s. But I feel like Connery, for the most part, has always been a pretty solid kind of tough actor. For the most part, meaning I didn't really enjoy him that much in the Indiana Jones movie or Entrapment. But aside from that, I feel Connery's been pretty solid over the years as being a pretty good tough guy as well.
And remember, Untouchables, mustache.
That's true. That's true. But yeah, Connery's been in some good stuff.
I want to get a little bit more modern with a guy who's still making films.
Okay.
But who I think is pretty badass and really doesn't get, like, enough recognition for being a badass and being macho, and that's Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah.
I really think, like, it's really sad that out of all those guys who came out in, like, the 80s, like Van Damme, Seagal, and all those, that Lundgren was the one that people didn't seem to really latch onto that much. And it's upsetting to me because he was the best actor out of all of them, for starters. And he was he just seemed to be, like, the most, like, kick-ass out of all of them, too. Like, he was the guy who was, like, efficient with the fisticuffs, efficient with the guns, and all that stuff. Like, I love 89's The Punisher. and I don't mm-hmm. care what anyone says. Like, I really do love that movie.
It's got its lovers, that's for sure.
Unfortunately, he did Masters of the Universe, but whatever, it happens, right? You know, his first movie is Rocky IV, pretty much. His first,
you know? He's great in that.
And you know, he's going to be in Creed II, playing Drago again.
Yeah.
Which I'm kind of not that stoked about, to be honest.
I have to see Creed 1 before I can make a judgment.
That's true, I guess. But, I mean, look at the guy. He's got a lot of underrated movies that no one really talks about a lot, like Dark Angel. You know...
I keep thinking that's the dog from Carnage. Remember that movie I reviewed?
Yeah.
The dog barking? That's all I'm thinking of. Anyway.
There's a dog barking outside in case you can't hear it. you know, we got Joshua Tree, which is a really great 1993 action movie that's inspired by Hong Kong action movies with, like, Dolph rolling along the ground on, like, one of those car mechanic flatbeds shooting people.
That's a great scene. What's the AKA for that again?
Army of One.
Army of One, right.
Yeah, and we also got Showdown in Little Tokyo with Brandon Lee.
Yeah.
We've got Universal Soldier with Van Damme. Like, this is a guy who's been solid his entire career, does have that kind of muscular, deep voice, kind of, this is the guy I want to protect me feeling to him, but nobody ever really gives him enough cred,
It's true.
And I've always been a Lundgren fan over all these other guys.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's why I wanted to mention him.
It's a good pick. No, that's definitely a good pick. He's in Pentathlon as well.
I've never seen that. Is that any good?
I know. I wish I didn't get rid of it. This is where when I get rid of VHS, then it comes up and then I'm like, fuck.
Did you ever see it though?
Yeah, of course I saw it.
And it was okay.
It's okay.
Isn't that the one where he's like an Olympian or something? And
he's a pentathlon Olympian.
And then he just starts shooting people?
No, then he gets like... I think he's like medically enhanced. And then the people that like... Yeah, that's it.
They want
something back, and whoa. So they track him down to his like retreat, and then it's like a siege type where he's got to like protect his family type movie.
Oh, and one more for him that I remembered that he also directed that it kicks so much fucking ass is a movie called The Russian Specialist.
Oh, really?
So if you track that one down, oh my god, so good!
Wow,
so good! Like nice. Top Dolph Lundgren movie for me.
Nice.
Even better than The Punisher.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
All right. That's not one I just feel like I would have gone to, but...
Yeah, Russian Specialist.
Nice.
So good.
Nice.
Easily available. It's on all those fucking Mill Creek sets.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know. Okay, another one that came up quickly for me when we were talking about this was James Caan. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think over his entire career, I don't know if I could go for him, but definitely during the 70s, I think his the scene where Sonny Corleone in The Godfather tracks down those fuckers that beat up his sister is one of the greatest tough guy scenes in movie history, as far as I'm concerned. So for that scene alone, James Caan gets an automatic pass. But aside from that, and just, he's really great in that movie in general. Aside from that, he was also in like Rollerball. He was in Hide in Plain Sight. He was in The Killer Elite. So he had a really good run of movies in the 70s, and he just always seemed like a tough motherfucker.
Well, and also Thief in the early 80s.
Yeah, another good one, yeah. Yeah, so he had a really great run. I don't have a ton to say about him, but I just wanted to... I wanted to mention that sequence in The Godfather, because when I think tough guy, that is one scene that I think of, and that, because it's just, he just is so kick-ass in that scene.
Well, and Rollerball was on my underrated 70s list, too.
Yeah.
So,
I
mean, he was a big part of Rollerball being on that list.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's a pretty good choice. But, yeah, like you said, I don't know if I'd go his entire career.
But not his entire career.
But definitely the 70s
The 70s. He was, like, one of the main guys for me. And, fuck, I tweeted about him recently, and he liked it, and I almost shit my pants.
Oh, the internet. What little things please us.
It really did. I was, like, starstruck completely.
I think I'm going to do the most obvious one that I haven't mentioned yet, and I'm not going to talk about him very long because he speaks for himself. I mean, he's been gone for a long time, but he's still got a fucking Twitter account. It's John Wayne.
Okay.
So obviously we have to put John Wayne on here.
Yeah.
I mean, why would you not? He's like kind of the original kind of tough guy, right? Like, this is a guy who was making multiple Westerns in the 40s, 50s, 60s, yeah, you know, and he was like just the hero of the day back then. Like, he was the guy who everyone would go see.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, the obvious choices for him are obviously True Grit and McClintock for the Western stuff. And, you know, I'm not, I can't say that I'm 100% familiar with John Wayne. I've not really watched a lot of his Westerns because, for me, I'm very selective about what kind of Westerns I watch because they all kind of have the same story in a way. Like, someone killed someone, so I'm going after them. It's kind of that most of the time is the story. But he's also in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance also. And, you know, I actually am very fascinated by his late 70s, like, cop movies. Like McHugh and Brannigan.
Yeah.
You know, like, I haven't seen them. But what I've seen of them, I'm like, I really want to see John Wayne play a cop in the 70s. I think that would just be, like, really different.
Yeah, I agree. I mean,
have you seen them?
I haven't seen them. I just picked up one of them. I think it was Brannigan. Brannigan's the one I picked up.
You picked up Brannigan?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how those are because he's mostly known for Westerns, obviously.
Yeah.
And to see him doing 70s cop movies, I was just like, oh, well, that's weird. And he's also got that iconic kind of voice and image that everybody thinks of when they think of tough guys. So I couldn't not at least bring him up.
Okay, well, I noticed two, like, very, very, like, terrifying absences from your list of John Wayne movies. So if you have not seen Rio Bravo or The Shootist, you need to see them both immediately.
I've seen Rio Bravo.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also The Cowboys, which is more of a lightweight Western of his where he's training all those younger kids to shoot and everything.
But The Shootist, I think Walter Hill directed. So
I have not seen The Shootist.
Yeah, you need to see that one.
But if Walter Hill is mentioned, it's definitely a seer.
That is a really great movie. Yeah.
Can I, let's jump off Walter Hill for a minute.
All right.
Because he's like one of the more macho film directors of all time. Him and Peckinpah, probably.
Yeah.
But one of the guys I have on my list is actually a guy who's been in a bunch of Walter Hill movies. And he's a guy that a lot of people might not know, and that's Powers Booth.
Oh, okay.
He was in Southern Comfort, mm-hmm. and he was the main bad guy in Extreme Prejudice, both directed by Hill. Extreme Prejudice is my favorite Nick Nolte movie of all time.
Yeah.
And that's like a modern Western, too. But Powers Booth is a guy, he was kind of played like either the bad guy or like the detective who was helping the good guys. So, you know, he was in Rapid Fire with Brandon Lee, where he played the detective helping out his character. And then he was in Van Damme's Sudden Death
as
the terrorist guy who kidnapped the president at the hockey game, right? But he's also in like Red Dawn. And he's just one of those recognizable faces. But every time I saw him, I was like, I always thought he was like just really like, you know, he lived up to the kind of standards that when I was making my list, he was on there for sure.
Nice.
So he was a quick mention too.
Good. That's a good one. Okay. How many, do you have a lot more?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more.
Holy crap.
I have 6 more.
All right.
I'm sure a couple of them will be on yours too.
All right, so I'm going to bring up Burt.
He was on mine.
Reynolds.
Obviously.
Now, Burt...
excuse me, it's just Burt.
Burt, I had a bit of trouble with.
Trouble with 80s Burt.
Not trouble, but I mean, I was just a little hesitant to put him on because of 80s. Kind of... It was... Well, 70s too, like his persona. Like he was macho, but he had that laugh.
He had that good old boy persona
and that like funny thing going on all the time, which kind of I thought took away from his edge a bit. But when you look at Sharky's Machine in particular, the Deliverance, the White Lightning and Gator.
Longest Yard, even
Longest Yard. I mean, he had some pretty kick-ass roles, and but yeah, it's just that was that whole 80s thing that kind of threw me off a little.
He was kind of borderline too, because he went from he was doing those kind of movies, but then he was kind of doing the movies with Hal Needham.
Yeah.
like Smokey the Bandit, Hooper, Stroke Race, where they were more kind of playing off of his like lightweight gig laughing Cannonball Run kind of persona. Yeah. And but then you had like movies like Paternity and, you know, where he tried to do comedies.
Yeah.
And that kind of like I wrote him down, but I was also like you. I'm kind of like, but is he kind of a tough guy? Or is it just those few roles like Deliverance and stuff that made him
into
a tough guy?
I hate to say it, man, but I almost think non-mustached Bert makes the list. Mustached Bert does not. But you did say Longest Yard. Mustached or not? I can't remember.
I think not.
But I think Sharky's Machine, I think he had one.
He does in Sharky's Machine, for sure. It's been a while since I've seen Longest Yard, and I've never seen
Sharky's. So if he didn't have one in Longest Yard, then that might be...
Non-mustache Bert non-mustache is much more Bert. Macho than Mustache Bert.
Which you totally see, wrecks the whole
but
argument.
But you see, the thing is, in the 80s, going with what Bert's persona was, he needed that mustache because he needed to ask women if they wanted a mustache ride.
He did.
Logic.
You know, I 80s Bert has a special place in my heart, but not a tough guy as far as I'm
early
concerned.
80s Bert,
except for Sharky's Machine. Yeah. And yeah. I guess Malone and those, I guess he started getting into that a
dude,
bit.
Dude, Malone's not that
I know
good.
It's not a good movie, but he was still...
What's that other one? Stick?
Stick, Heat.
Isn't... Which is the one that was remade as a Statham movie, Wild Card?
Oh, that was...
Wasn't that like...
I think it might have been Heat.
Heat, yeah. Heat. Yeah, yeah. That wasn't very good. I saw that recently, and it wasn't very good.
I saw the Statham movie. It also was not very good.
You know what actually the worst 80s Bert movie was? Was probably Rent-A-Cop with Liza Minnelli.
Oh, yeah.
Mainly because it was Liza Minnelli being a prostitute. And I couldn't for the life of me imagine anyone paying for Liza Minnelli.
Poor Liza Minnelli.
Like 80s Liza Minnelli. Late 80s. I can't see it. I'm sorry. Well, maybe
didn't the whole Bluth family go through her in Arrested Development?
Maybe Cabaret Liza Minnelli I could see people paying for, but not fucking Rent-A-Cop.
No Boner Minnelli. That's
no. That's her. Liza No Boner Minnelli. You should go edit her Wikipedia page.
Well, you can go make that change. I've never found Liza Minnelli attractive at all. But...
Well, no, but I'm just saying. That movie was not good.
No, because she's not a prostitute. I get it. I totally get it.
Nope. They should have just reunited Bert with Lonnie Anderson from Stroke Race to make Rent-A-Cop. Lonnie Anderson as a prostitute is a lot more
okay.
It's a lot more viable. I told you we didn't research. This is off the rails. It's okay.
Oh my god. Okay, no, true. Very true, Chris. Lonnie Anderson as a prostitute is much more viable than Liza Minnelli.
Let's make a list of actresses we think could be good as prostitutes. Go.
Whoopi Goldberg, no.
Goldie Hawn.
Has that happened?
Whoopi Goldberg?
Has Whoopi Goldberg
frosted? No, but Goldie Hawn's played a stripper.
Okay, that's okay.
Okay, back to...
Okay. Okay, I mentioned Bert. Now, who are you going to mention?
Let's see, who do I have left? Ray Liotta.
Oh, good one.
Ray Liotta.
Yeah.
Not so much a tough guy in the heroic sense of being a tough guy.
Yeah.
But a tough guy in, like, he was a psychopath most of his career in his films. And now he's being, like, a mobster and kind of a cop.
Yeah.
So my examples of that are obviously in Narc, where he's a crooked cop. Something Wild, which is the first Ray Liotta movie I ever saw. And I love Something Wild to this day. Underrated 80s.
Yeah.
Turbulence.
Right.
Where he's on a plane and he's a psychopath and Lauren Holly's a stewardess and she's super hot, but he's like killing people on board the plane. That's a good one. Unlawful Entry with Kurt, and he's a psychopathic cop. And of course, he watches Kurt and Madeline Stowe get down and busy, and then he's a psychopath with them. Seems to be a trend, right?
Yeah.
No Escape from 1994. Kind of an underrated post-apocalyptic movie where he's on like a prison island.
Yeah.
And there's spikes in the ground, and he's really good in that. And he's just like, he's just one of those guys where every time he shows up, you're like, he's either going to be unhinged or he's going to be like one of those guys you don't want to mess with.
Yeah.
So that's why he made it onto my list for sure.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good choice.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So I'm just going to very briefly mention a couple, because we're not really going to talk about like black actors today.
No.
But I did feel like, in this discussion, I at least need to mention Fred
Williamson.
Yeah, the
reason we're not is because we're planning on a blaxploitation episode in the future, and we didn't want to, you know, ruin it.
But if we did a top five, then we probably wouldn't. Anyway, I just wanted to mention Fred Williamson and Richard Roundtree in particular.
Yeah.
Because they were both kind of like the definition of what this episode's about in their various films, Roundtree particularly in the Shaft franchise. So just needed to throw those two names out there. But I guess my next main one, I did want to bring up Harrison Ford, just because, you know, I know people might not think of him right off the bat as one of these guys. But in the fucking Indiana Jones movies and his Han Solo, I mean, he's another like kind of like, he's just so obvious as this type of role that you almost forget about him. And but I mean, you don't get much more cool and tough than Indiana Jones or Han Solo, particularly again in the first movies of both franchises. But I still think both of those guys were so cool. And Harrison Ford's been in some other stuff that's really great as well. I mean, we can talk about like Frantic, we could talk about Witness. So he's been just a really, and even back to like American Graffiti, like he's been always kind of like one of those cool dudes. And I would be remiss to not mention Harrison Ford in this discussion.
I'm going to quickly bring up David Carradine then.
Of course.
Because, you know, Kung Fu, the TV series, obviously, when I was a kid, was a big thing for me on those Sunday mornings when I was watching Wanted, Dead or Alive and Kung Fu.
Right.
But for us, obviously, it's Death Race 2000.
Yeah.
Was the movie that we both are kind of like, Carradine's cool.
Yeah.
Because he played Frankenstein in that movie. He was also in Cannonball, which was another Paul Bartel directed kind of road race movie. And I just remember him a lot from being in like, you know, Fred Olen Ray movies in the 80s.
Yeah,
you know,
with like Lee Van Cleef in Armed Response.
Yeah, like Armed Response and Warlords and stuff like that. But, you know, there's other stuff. There's a Circle of Iron where he was like a martial artist guy who travels to like the middle, I think it's the Middle East or Asia. That's a Blue Underground DVD that's easy to come by. And then obviously we've got what's the other one I wrote down? Thunder and Lightning. Mm-hmm. That moonshining cycle of his career where he was making movies like Thunder and Lightning with Kate Jackson.
Yeah.
Where he was the, you know, the good old boy running the moonshine across the state lines and stuff like that.
Yeah, you so like that movie a lot.
I mean, his later career when he went into the B-movie stuff and kind of, you know, apart from Kill Bill.
Dude, he's fucking Bill. Like, that's pretty cool.
Well, I know. Like, apart from Kill Bill.
But I'm saying,
he was just one of those guys where he was just, you know.
Yeah.
He was a presence.
Yeah.
You know, even in these kind of junky B-movies he's making for Roger Corman, like Crime Zone and stuff like that.
Did you mention Lone Wolf McQuade?
I didn't mention Lone Wolf McQuade.
You did?
I didn't.
Yeah, he's pretty
badass.
But
I do have it written down. That's a Chuck Norris where he plays the bad guy.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Carradine I had to bring up.
Nice. Nice. Okay. I'm also going to bring up another fairly obvious one, and that's Al Pacino. And again, like, his most recent, like a lot of his recent career has been a bit of a dip.
Him and De Niro, both
of them. But and De Niro was a pretty tough guy as well. But I think Pacino might edge him out just slightly because he was
Serpico and Mean Streets alone.
So well, was Pacino wasn't in Mean Streets
or Serpico?
Yeah, Serpico and The Godfather Part Two and The Godfather Part One, for that matter. I thought Pacino was just awesome. He was also awesome in The Panic at Needle Park. He's also great in Heat, the Michael Mann movie. I mean, he's been in a lot of great stuff, and I just think he's got that cool voice. And
well, come on, dude, Scarface. The movie everybody loves.
I don't really love Scarface. And, you know, actually, Scarface kind of takes away a little bit from...
Confession, I've never seen it.
From, yeah, it kind of takes away a little bit from our theory, because I didn't really think he was a tough guy. Well, he was a tough guy for, like, part of Scarface.
But Scarface is the movie that everyone equates with him being a tough guy.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. I don't know what it is with Scarface and me. Like, I think he was, yeah, I don't know. I don't think of it. See, I didn't even mention
it. I think since the 90s, it's just been a frat boy thing to love Scarface.
Yeah.
Like all these douchey white boys who are like, I love Scarface, man. It's so fucking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's what it is.
I got to revisit Scarface.
I've never seen it, so.
But I'm talking, when I think of Pacino, I'm thinking of The Godfather and I'm thinking Serpico.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was pretty rad.
And he's really good in Dog Day Afternoon, but he's not particularly a tough guy.
Definitely not a tough guy.
But really good anyway.
Yeah.
And even in Injustice for All, the Norman Jewison movie from the late 70s, he plays a lawyer in it, but he's just such a tough lawyer.
Yeah.
So I really like that movie too with him.
Yeah.
All right, so... Josh, should I bring up one that I surprised you haven't brought up yet and let you go on it because this is much more in your wheelhouse? Why haven't you brought up Tom Laughlin yet?
Oh.
Why didn't you bring him up?
Oh, my God. I'm embarrassed. Wow. I don't know because I guess because I was just... I didn't even think about him for one thing. And I think because he's only really developed one character.
Well, I mean, all of his movies, he basically wrote and directed and starred in pretty much everything he was in. And obviously, Billy Jack's his character.
Yes.
But come on, is there more of an iconic kind of character than Billy Jack from the 70s particularly?
Well, I mean, for
cult fans and stuff.
Unfortunately, I feel like Billy Jack is like... being lost with the fucking sands of time, and it's killing me because you know how I feel about Tom Laughlin. I've loved the Billy Jack movies, like loved, and Chris has known this like since he's known me.
Yep.
I've got Tom Laughlin autographed picture, and which I'm really thankful for that I managed to get that before he passed away. But he was like just such a cool dude. A total independent filmmaker, and Billy Jack is an American icon that is being lost, unfortunately. But I would urge you, if you want to just see, like, go, you know, just Google like Billy Jack kicks ass at the park or something.
Oh, that's the best.
And there is an amazing scene, and you will completely I'll post it on our Facebook page. But, Billy Jack is just such an iconic figure and just, kind of like the epitome of cool, tough guy. But I guess I just didn't think about it because it's only,
He didn't do a lot of things, right? But I'm just surprised you hadn't brought him up yet.
Yeah, I'm surprised too. So that's a good call.
But, I mean, the thing is that for us, kids of the 80s and 70s, and that we know Billy Jack.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I mean... they botched the Blu-ray release of Billy Jack, right? Like the series?
Yeah, and I'm really upset about that. They Shout Factory, which is bizarre, really fucked that one up. They blew the aspect ratios. They blew the cuts of the films. And they haven't fixed it, which is really uncharacteristic of that company because usually those guys are all over everything. But it's like this one, for some reason, even though people have like... called them out on it, they've just been like, it's the best you're gonna get, so live with it. I mean, the big problem with Billy Jack movies is that Laughlin and Dolores Taylor own, their husband and wife, they owned the rights, and maybe the family still does, but they've been really difficult to get those films out. I mean, the prints I have are like pan and scan. Like it's really terrible. But I saw, the movie The Babysitter that Mick G did move for Netflix does have a major, major, major reference to Billy Jack in it, which is amazing. But I wish something else would kind of bring that back because it is such a cool character, but it is kind of Tom Laughlin's only character.
Well, yeah, he did four movies as Billy Jack.
Yeah.
Unfinished fifth movie.
Yeah.
Which I wish would have happened, called The Return of Billy Jack. Because it's Billy Jack versus child pornographers. And I think that would have been pretty awesome.
It would have been awesome.
So, yeah, I just want to quickly bring him up because I know he's one of the guys that you have always loved.
I really love him. Yeah. Yeah.
So I can keep going.
Yeah, do it.
How about Dennis Farina?
Ooh, that's an interesting choice.
Mustache.
Got a mustache. Great in Crime Story.
He's just, if you've
seen, I don't know where I'd go from there, though.
If you've seen any movie where there's a gruff cop or a gangster and he's Italian descent or whatever, it's probably Dennis Farina.
Yeah.
This is a guy who made his career playing those types of characters. He was in Michael Mann's Manhunter as like one of the detective guys. Yeah. He was in Code of Silence with Chuck Norris. He was in Midnight Run as like the rival, one of the rival guys to De Niro's character, and he was awesome in that. He had a run on Law and Order, and he was in a bunch of movies for PM Entertainment in the early 90s. He's just a guy that when he popped up all the time, you were always like, Dennis Farina is rad. He's a kick-ass guy.
Now, the only counterpoint I would give to a guy like Dennis Farina is that he's more like a character actor, in my opinion.
Well, he's
not a leading man, which is kind of what we're focusing on.
Yeah.
And I think those guys are still around. I think it's more the lead guy.
But technically, Powers Booth isn't a lead guy either.
True. But I think we're really starting to get into that territory now of a character actor versus a leading tough guy that's carrying a movie. You know what I mean?
Well, he carried the movies when he was PM Entertainment. He was the lead.
Yeah.
In those movies.
I just don't know if I've seen those movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I just think I always thought of him to be like one of those tough
He was side great characters. In Crime Story, and yeah. I will totally give you that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was a great TV series. Michael Mann, I think.
Yeah, Michael Mann, yeah.
Yeah, that was a great TV series from the 80s? Might have been the
80s. I think it was mid-80s.
Didn't last very long. It was like one or two seasons, but it was really good. And
I think you can get the whole thing on DVD now.
You can, and he was the lead in that, so
yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of running out of, like, steam here, and I am starting to reach a bit, so... You know, I mean, I'll just briefly mention a couple of the other ones I have. I've got Chuck.
Yeah.
Norris, of course. Is he on your list? Like, I think he was a leading dude, and he kicked ass, and he did have that cool quality about him. You know, but there's certain Chuck movies that I always go to in my head that are probably the wrong Chuck movies. But if I'm, like, focusing more on, like, Forced Vengeance like that or An Eye for an Eye, then I think he totally fits the bill. But if I start going into like Delta Force territory, I feel like
missing an action.
Yeah, then we're kind of losing it. So he's kind of like not an inconsistent tough guy.
Forced Vengeance, no mustache.
Yeah, Forced Vengeance, he was rad as An Eye for an Eye. George Kennedy, you've already mentioned, but again, more of a character actor.
Yeah, and another guy who's a character actor I had written down was William Smith, who was in like all those 70s biker flicks.
Totally
like,
character actor, yeah.
Angels Die Hard and The Losers. Yeah. And then he was in blaxploitation movies like Samson and Hammer. Yeah. And then lots of low-budget 80s action flicks like, you know, Bulletproof with Gary Busey and stuff like that. So I always thought he was like a tough character actor.
Yeah.
So...
I've only got a couple more that I'll just quickly mention. One's James Coburn. And, the only reason I didn't mention it, I'm not really getting into detail on him. I'm just not familiar with a lot of his work. I know him from like Our Man Flint and In Like Flint, but those are more comedies but he was still pretty cool. But I do know when he showed up in the Muppet movie, I thought he was pretty badass. And I know he's a name that's thrown around in these types of conversations
quite
a bit.
One day you'll find it, the Rainbow Connection.
And the other one I wanted to mention is someone from my love of Italian movies that I think is pretty cool, and that's David Warbeck. And he was, of course, the lead in the Beyond. He was also in a really great movie called The Last Hunter, where he was a lead in that as well. He was supposed to be Bond one day, and I always thought he'd be more like a Connery-type Bond. But he was a really cool dude. But I, again, not familiar with a lot of his career, so I don't know if I can really give him a full vote of confidence in this conversation. But I mean, I think people are getting the idea of kind of what we're trying to say. Did you have any more others that you wanted to add?
No, I'm tapped.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just kind of tired. But but we've talked about a lot of people tonight, and I guess that's what happens when you wing it. But I think, you know, I mean, I hope people will kind of get the idea from this list and maybe kind of look back at some of these other guys and yeah, maybe yearn for those days, or maybe go back and look at some of these older movies.
Well, and the thing I think is that even people like us who were kind of grew up in the 80s and 90s, for us, our definition of tough guys was like Van Damme and Seagal and guys like that. And to me, that's not really what I was looking for when I was compiling this.
Yeah.
You know, like Lundgren, I was, because even though he was doing those kind of movies, he was the guy who nobody really paid attention to.
Yeah.
So he could make more. He was, you know, his movies were more kind of off the cuff, and he was more tough in those, right? So that's why he was there. But like, I like watching Van Damme movies, but I'm not going to look at Van Damme and be like, that's the guy I want to like protect me if I'm in danger.
Yeah.
I'm going to go, if I watch a Bronson movie, I'm like, I'm perfectly fine with him, you know, keeping me safe during an apocalypse or during an anarchic breakout or something. Yeah. I'm okay with that. So I think that's kind of what, for me, I was personally trying to say, like, these are guys who, they were normal guys generally.
Yeah.
But they were the kind of guys who, like, kind of like a role model. I was going more with, like, a role model, kind of like, if this guy was your dad, he'd be the greatest dad that ever existed.
Yeah, kind of like a hero almost, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Like, I was going more with heroes than action stars.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's kind of what I was going for when I made my choices.
Yeah, and there's a big difference.
So, big difference. All right, so we're done.
We're done. So I guess I will see you in like a month.
Yep.
And we will talk to all you. Well, hopefully we're going to space these out so it's not that much of a wait.
Yeah, this one will go up next, like,
we're not sure when it's going to go up.
But it'll go up eventually, but it'll only cause like a one extra week gap between episodes. So it's not too bad. But in the meantime, you know, it's not like we don't have 92 other episodes you can listen to. It's not like you can't go on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and search for GBW Podcast and talk to us.
Yep.
Well, talk to Josh, because I probably won't have Wi-Fi access. And, you know, there's always iTunes to rate and review us. We're on Stitcher. We're on Spotify. Most importantly, tell your friends. Show them how to subscribe. Show them how to listen to the show. And, you know, let's get a conversation going.
All right.
All right. Till next time.
Enjoy your summer.
You love summer. Ha ha ha.